This file was created by readthewords.com. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the ancient Greek philosopher Socrates taught his students that the pursuit of truth can only begin once they start to question and analyze every belief that they ever held dear. If a certain belief passes the tests of evidence, deduction, and logic, it should be kept. If it doesn't, the belief should not only be discarded, but the thinker must also then question why he was led to believe the erroneous information, in the first place. Not surprisingly, this type of teaching didn't sit well with the ruling elite of Greece. Many political leaders throughout history have always sought to mislead the thinking of the masses. Socrates was tried for subversion, and for corrupting the youth. He was then forced to take his own life by drinking poison. It's never easy being an independent thinker. Today, our ruling government/media complex doesn't kill people for pursuing the truth about the world, at least not yet. They simply label them as extremists or paranoid, destroying careers and reputations in the process. For many, that's a fate even worse than drinking poison hemlock. Every news story you are about to review in this comprehensive research paper is true, and easily verifiable. This investigation represents 10 months of careful study, research, analysis, source verification, and logical deduction. Every event and quote presented here is 100% accurate. There are over 190 detailed footnotes which I urge readers to explore and verify for themselves. The internet version of this paper will allow users to obtain instant verification for each and every footnote by clicking on the footnote/links. Others can obtain easy verification by entering the key search words provided at the end of the paper into the Yahoo or Google.com search engines. Due to the fact that well-organized efforts are underway to suppress these facts, some of these news links are mysteriously disappearing even as we speak. Fortunately, this information has all been transcribed by many web users and has therefore been preserved from the censors. These footnote searches will take you directly to the news sites of many well-known established media organizations throughout the world, as well as opening up doors to a world of knowledge and information that has been concealed from you. With just a little common sense and a few clicks of a mouse, Google and Yahoo now enable anyone with an ounce of curiosity to become a Sherlock Holmes. This is no opinion piece. Rather, it is a collection of buried but undeniable facts, events, and quotes which, when assembled in one place, will state their own conclusions. In putting together this research in logical and sequential format, great care was taken to confirm and double confirm every piece of information. Any and all questionable data which could not be independently verified to this author's satisfaction was discarded. Taken individually, each story, quote, and event may not amount to a full case. But when taken collectively, this mountain of facts should hammer home the truth to even the most skeptical reader. There are, of course, those who have fallen under the hypnotic spell of the TV talking heads and experts, whom they worship as authority figures. Unaccustomed to thinking for themselves, no amount of truth can sway them from their preconceived prejudices. They will even deny that which they see with their own eyes. They are victims of a psychological affliction known as the lemming effect. Lemmings are small rodents who have been known to follow each other as they charge to their deaths into raging rivers or off of cliffs. Lemminghood is an innate psychological phenomenon present in most mammals and observable in common people as well as the most sophisticated and educated elites. Lemminghood is not an intellectual phenomenon, it is psychological. As such, no socioeconomic class is immune to its strangulating effect. A grant-seeking university scientist can be a lemming just as much as a fashion-obsessed teenage girl. One blindly follows the latest trendy theory, while the other blindly follows the latest trendy clothing style. What's the difference? Neither can resist the force of nature. The power to fit in with one's social peers can be irresistible. To a human lemming, the logic behind an opinion doesn't count as much as the power and popularity behind an opinion. Man, like lemming, behaves collectively. And it could be no other way. Naturally, the individual must be equipped with this trait. Otherwise, the smallest steps towards civilization could never have been made. Lemminghood is a survival trait, an inborn instinct in the majority of people. However, as with all natural phenomena, this tendency can be manipulated and used for harmful purposes. It is this lemming effect which enables entire segments of a society to lose their sense of judgment all at the same time. This research paper will likely be wasted on many lemmings. For lemmings, denial is a basic psychological defense mechanism used to not only shield themselves from unpleasant realities, but also to reassure themselves that they will still fit within the acceptable range of opinion held by their peer group. Lemmings are absolutely terrified at the thought of being labeled as an extremist or a conspiracy theorist. At all costs, their beliefs must always be on the right side of the issue and conform within the boundaries of their lemming peers. Lemmings simply cannot bear the burden of responsibility or the discomfort which comes with thinking independently. They'll resist any efforts to change their misguided beliefs with all their mental energy. We can try to open their closed minds and free them from their self-imposed blindness, but it is not easy fighting the force of human nature. The chains of ideological conformity have too strong of a grip, and breaking them is a difficult task. With the limited resources at our disposal, it is next to impossible to compete with the media lemming masters. Nevertheless, some of us must make the meager attempt, and thus lay the foundation upon which the truth might one day rise again. There are those among us who do have the courage and intellectual capacity to break free of the shackles of lemminghood and accept the truth when it is presented in a clear and logical sequence. To those open-minded and independent thinkers, I wish to state clearly and unequivocally. I intend to set forth in this paper an overwhelming body of evidence which should forever destroy the notion that a Saudi Arabian caveman and his band of half-trained, nerdy Arab flight school attendees orchestrated the most sophisticated terror operation in world history. The idea is utterly laughable. And yet, due to the blittering barrage of bullshit dished out by the government/media complex, patriotic Americans have accepted this ridiculous fairy tale with a religious conviction. As a public service to my fellow Americans, I have published the results of my research in the hopes of liberating as many people as I can from the oppressive yoke of media brainwashing and state-sponsored lies. Do you have what it takes to break free? If so, read on. Like most Americans, I was gripped by senses of profound shock, horror, revulsion, sadness, and rage as I watched the horror of September 11, 2001 unfolding live on my television screen. Watching the mass murder of thousands of innocent people live on television was the most upsetting experience of my life. How could any person of sound moral character not be enraged at witnessing this horrific act of barbarism? To read about some faraway, long-ago genocide in a newspaper or a book is distressing enough. But to actually witness the mass murders of what was, at first, believed to have been tens of thousands of innocent people is truly heart-stopping and traumatic. I barely slept for two nights afterwards and suffered nightmares. Polling data would later reveal that 65% of Americans actually shed tears on 9/11. But not all of the eyewitnesses to the 9/11 slaughter were so saddened. On September 11, five Israeli Army veterans were arrested by the FBI after several witnesses saw them dancing, high-fiving and celebrating as they took pictures of the World Trade Center disaster from across the river in New Jersey. Stephen Gordon was the lawyer who volunteered to represent the five Israelis. He was asked by a Hebrew newspaper why the five men were being detained by the FBI. Here's what Gordon told Yediot America. On the day of the disaster, three of the five boys went up on the roof of the building, where the company office is located, said Gordon. I'm not sure if they saw the Twin Towers collapse, but, in any event, they photographed the ruins right afterwards. One of the neighbors who saw them called the police, and claimed they were posing, dancing, and laughing, against the background of the burning towers. Anyhow, the three left the roof, took an urban truck, and drove to a parking lot, located about a 5-minute drive from the offices. They parked, stood on the roof of the truck to get a better view of the destroyed towers, and took photographs. A woman who was in the building, above the lot, testified that she saw them smiling and exchanging high fives. She and another neighbor called the police, and reported on Middle Eastern-looking people dancing on the truck. They copied and reported the license plates. When the photos were developed, they revealed that the dancing Israelis were smiling in the foreground of the New York massacre. According to ABC's 20/20 attempted whitewash of the incident, In addition to their outrageous and highly suspicious behavior, the five also had in their possession the following items: box cutters, European passports, and $4,700 cash hidden in a sock. Why were these Israeli agents so happy about the horrible massacre that was unfolding right before their very eyes? What evil spirit could possess people who are supposed to be America's allies and who receive billions of dollars in financial and military aid from U.S. taxpayers each year to publicly rejoice as innocent people, including many American Jews, were burning to death and jumping out of 110-story buildings? Could it be that these happy Israeli army veterans were in some way linked to this monstrous attack? That's what officials close to the investigation initially told the Bergen Record newspaper of New Jersey. As incredible, as ridiculous, and as paranoid as that belief may appear to you at this point, the fact is that certain elements within the Israeli government, and Zionist movement in general, have a long history of attacking the USA and framing Arabs in order to gain support from the US. Before we begin to piece together what really transpired on 9/11, it is absolutely critical that we first review some historical precedents regarding Israel's and international Zionism's treacherous history of manipulating America and other nations for their own selfish purposes. Without a basic understanding of this history, it would be impossible to understand the truth as it is today. So put aside your preconceived notions, your psychological defense mechanisms, and your prejudices, and step into my time machine for a journey down the memory hole. In the latter part of the 1800s, there arose in Europe a political movement known as Zionism. Zionism in particular referred to the effort among certain Jews to establish a Jewish nation in the land of Palestine. Today, the term Zionism is more commonly applied to those Jews who want to expand the borders of what was already established, at the expense of the Palestinians who once owned the land. In a more general sense, the term Zionist is also used to describe a certain element within the Jewish community, not all of them, who believe in Jewish supremacy, thus putting their own interests ahead of those of the nation in which they reside. It is a mistake to assume that all Jews are supporters of the Zionist mafia or Jewish supremacy. In fact, some of the strongest condemnations of Zionism and Jewish supremacy comes from Jews themselves. There exists an enormous collection of hard-hitting anti-Zionist writings compiled by such notable Jewish authors, historians, and journalists as John Sack, Alfred Lilienthal, Noam Chomsky, Israel Shahak, Benjamin Friedman, and Viktor Ostrovsky, just to name a few. There is even a Jewish religious group called Natu Reichharta, Jews United Against Zionism. For their brave efforts, these men have had to tolerate vicious abuse from Zionist smear groups, like the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, an organization which actually specializes in defamation. So let us put to rest now, and forever, the slanderously and strategic Zionist propaganda ploy that labels anyone who dares to call attention to the dangers of the Zionist mafia as an anti-Semite, a hatemonger, or a skinhead. Now the Zionists of the late 1800s faced one small problem with their bold takeover scheme of Arab Palestine. Palestine was under the sovereignty of the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and the Arabs certainly weren't about to just give away prime real estate in Palestine to the Zionists of Europe. There were very few Jews even living in Palestine, and the Jews had not controlled Palestine since the days of the Roman Empire. This destroys the commonly believed myth that the Arabs and the Jews have been fighting over that land for centuries. The handful of Arab Jews who lived in Palestine got along well with their Muslim hosts and never expressed any desire whatsoever to overthrow the Ottoman rulers and set up a nation called Israel. The movement to strip Palestine away from the Ottoman Empire came strictly from European Zionists who had become very influential within several European nations. As fate, or perhaps design, would have it, a great opportunity would soon present itself to the Zionist mafia. There came in 1914 the great war pitting the three powers of Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Turkish Empire against the three powers of England, France, and Russia. In the interests of staying on the subject of 9/11 and today's war on terrorism, we won't get into all of the underlying causes or the historical flow of World War I. What we need to understand is that the Zionists played an important role in dragging the USA into that bloody European war, a war in which the US had no vital interests at stake whatsoever. Here was the situation. By 1916, the Germans, Austrians, and Ottoman Turks had seemingly won the war. Russia was in turmoil and about to be swallowed up by communist revolution. France had suffered horrible losses, and Britain was under a German U-boat blockade. Germany made an offer to Britain to end the war under conditions favorable to Britain. But the British and the international Zionists had one more card to play. The British government and the Zionist leaders struck a dirty deal. The Zionists were led by Chaim Weizmann, the man who one day became the first president of the State of Israel. The idea was for the Zionists to use their influence to drag the mighty USA into the war on Britain's side so that Germany and its Ottoman allies could be crushed. In exchange for helping to bring the USA into the war, the British would reward the Zionists by taking over Palestine from the conquered Ottomans after the war was over. The British had originally wanted to give the Zionists a Jewish homeland and an African territory. But the Zionists were fixated on claiming Palestine as their land. Once under British control, the Jews of Europe would be allowed to immigrate to Palestine in great numbers. Zionist power brokers such as Bernard Brook, Louis Brandeis, Paul Warburg, Jacob Schiff, and many others immediately went to work to put the screws to President Woodrow Wilson. The Zionist-influenced press quickly transformed the German Kaiser and his people into bloodthirsty Huns determined to destroy civilization. In 1916, the U.S., with the help of the Lusitania incident, entered the war on Britain's side under the ridiculous pretext of making the world safe for democracy. Meanwhile in Germany, where Zionists also wielded tremendous influence in the press and industry, enthusiasm for the war was suddenly watered down by Zionist-run newspapers. Wartime labor strikes in German weapons factories were organized by Zionist and Marxist union leaders. With the German branch of the International Zionist Mafia undermining Germany from within, and the English and American branches of the Zionist Mafia pushing America to join the war, it wasn't long before the German, Austrian, and Ottoman empires were defeated and their maps rewritten by the victorious powers at the infamous Treaty of Versailles in 1918. In addition to the numerous Zionist bankers who were influencing Versailles, the Zionists also had their own delegation which was headed by Chaim Weizmann. Great Britain issued the Balfour Declaration in November 1917, the same month that Germany surrendered. But it had actually been prepared 20 months earlier in March 1916, with Weizmann's influence. The declaration allowed mass Jewish immigration to conquered Palestine, while promising to preserve Arab rights. The Arabs living in Palestine weren't buying these promises. They protested, but there was nothing that they could do to stop the coming wave of Jewish immigration. This was the first step in creating what was to later become the State of Israel 20 years later. Years after the war, an American Zionist millionaire named Benjamin Friedman broke ranks with his fellow Zionists and turned against them. Friedman was the principal owner of the Woodbury Soap Company and was one of the many Zionists present at the Treaty of Versailles. Friedman was very well connected and had enjoyed access to several U.S. presidents. Friedman grew disgusted with the criminal behavior of the Zionist Mafia and dedicated much of his life and fortune to exposing the truth about both world wars and the Zionist grip on America. According to Friedman, Wilson had been blackmailed by Zionists with the threat of a public disclosure of an old extramarital affair Wilson had when he was president of Princeton University. Friedman's voluminous and varied writings and books on this subject are essential reading. One leader of the Jewish Anti-Defamation League, Arnold Forster, once described Friedman as a self-hating Jew. "We may debate as to exactly what extent the Zionist British dirty deal was responsible for dragging the sons of America off to die in a European bloodbath. Some, such as Friedman, believe it was the only reason that the U.S. entered the war. Others, such as this writer, believe it was a primary contributing factor. But let us at this point agree on this one irrefutable point: the Zionists had no aversion to seeing Americans die for their own selfish interests. Even the Encyclopedia Britannica and Microsoft and Carta Encyclopedia, Look Under Balfour Declaration, confirm this little-known fact of World War I. Here's the excerpt from Microsoft and Carta, the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration was a letter prepared in March 1916 and issued in November 1917 during World War I by the British statesman Arthur James Balfour, then Foreign Secretary, specifically. The letter expressed the British government's approval of Zionism, with the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. The letter committed the British government to making the best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done to prejudice the rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. The immediate purpose was to win for the Allied cause in World War I the support of Jews in the warring nations and in the United States. As a result of the Balfour Declaration, Israel was established as an independent state in 1948 in the mandated area. It's also worth mentioning at this point that when the British dismantled the Ottoman Empire after World War I, they created many smaller nations. The oil-rich puppet kingdom of Kuwait was formed by slicing off the southern coastal tip of what we now know as the nation of Iraq. As a result of this arbitrary redrawing of the Ottoman map, a bitter conflict was created between Iraq and Kuwait. Iraq has always considered Kuwait as its true southern province. This is what ultimately led to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in 1991 and the Gulf War. Let us fast forward our time machine to the early 1930s again. There is no need for a detailed analysis and debate of the causes and major events of World War II. The purpose here is to again illustrate yet another case of selfish Zionist agitation for American entry into a war. The German people were bitterly resentful of not only the Zionist role in bringing about their defeat in World War I, but also over the brutal monetary reparations which had been imposed upon them by certain Zionist bankers who helped craft the brutal Treaty of Versailles after the war. Stripped of formerly German territory, and with the German economy in ruins, the people of Germany elected Adolf Hitler as their chancellor leader. Hitler and the Nazi Party soon seized control of the German media, banks, and universities away from the influential Zionists who reigned supreme in those institutions. Almost immediately, Zionists all over the world began to agitate for action against Germany. Boycotts of German imports were imposed, and calls for the UK and USA to take immediate action against Germany began to emanate from Zionist circles. On March 24, 1933, the Daily Express of England carried the bold headline, "Judea declares war on Germany. Jews of all the world unite in action." The front page story revealed that the Zionists had announced a concerted worldwide effort to isolate Germany and turn other nations against her. The following year, Zionist political leader Vladimir Jabotinsky wrote, "The fight against Germany has now been waged for months by every Jewish community on every continent. We shall start a spiritual and material war of the world against Germany. Our Jewish interests call for the complete destruction of Germany." A few years later, Lord Beaverbrook, a British newspaper magnate, issued this warning about the Zionist influence over the British press. Beaverbrook warned, "There are 20,000 German Jews who have come here to England. They all work against an agreement with Germany. The Jews have got a big position in the press here. Their political influence is driving us into the direction of war." In 1939, Germany and Poland went to war over disputed territory that was taken away from Germany by the Versailles Treaty of 1918. Under the phony pretext of protecting Poland, Great Britain and France immediately declared war on Germany. Beaverbrook's prediction was realized. In the United States, the Zionist mafia again went to work on a U.S. president. The names of the players had changed, but the game was still the same. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt destined to deliver the U.S. into another European war. Patriotic Americans such as famed aviator Charles Lindbergh saw this and tried to warn the American people that Zionist media influence was intending to drive us into another world war. Said Lindbergh, "I am not attacking the Jewish people. But I am saying that the leaders of both the British and the Jewish races, for reasons which are as understandable from their viewpoint as they are inadvisable from ours, for reasons which are not American, wish to involve us in the war. Because of strong public anti-war sentiment, FDR and his Zionist allies had a hard time dragging the U.S. into the European war." Then another incident came along at Pearl Harbor in 1941. Japan and Germany were bound to a mutual defense agreement, which meant that war with Japan would automatically mean war with Germany. FDR embargoed Japan's oil supply in the hopes of forcing Japan to attack Pearl Harbor. Overwhelming evidence from government documents clearly shows that FDR had advance knowledge of the Japanese attack and allowed it to happen so that he could drag the U.S. into World War II. As was the case in WWI, U.S. entry the war meant another defeat of Germany. Hours before committing suicide on April 30, 1945, Adolf Hitler dictated his last will and political testament. In it he placed responsibility for WW2 on the Zionist Mafia, or, as he called it, International Jewry, and its henchmen. It's no surprise that Hitler would make such a claim. However, his final accusation of the Zionists does parallel the statements made by Jabotinsky, Lindbergh, Beaverbrook, Joe Kennedy, and many others. In the final writing of his life, Hitler wrote, "It is untrue that I or anyone else in Germany wanted war in 1939. It was wanted and provoked solely by international statesmen, either of Jewish origin or working for Jewish interests, nor had I ever wished that after the appalling First World War, there would ever be a second against either England or America." Regardless of your view of World War II, and whether or not the USA belonged in the fight, the essential point which cannot be refuted is again this: years before World War II had even started, the Zionists had yet again demonstrated that they had no aversion to sending Americans to die for their own interests. A few years after the end of World War II, the Zionist plan to establish the nation of Israel in Palestine was finally realized. But not before the British protectors of Palestine were chased out by acts of terror carried out by ungrateful Zionist terrorists. It was the British who had taken Palestine away from Arab control and allowed the Jews of Europe to immigrate there. But with Great Britain weakened and in debt from the war, the ungrateful Zionists saw their opportunity to chase the British out of Palestine by committing acts of terrorism against them. The most notorious of the Zionist terror groups was the Ergun, whose leader Menachem Begin would one day go on to become Prime Minister of Israel. On the morning of July 22, 1946, of 15 to 20 Ergun terrorists dressed as Arabs entered the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. They unloaded 225 kilograms of explosives hidden in milk churns. The King David Hotel housed the Secretariat of the Government of Palestine and headquarters of the British forces in Palestine. When a British officer became suspicious, a shootout took place, and the Ergun lit the fuses and fled. The explosion destroyed part of the hotel and killed 91 people. Most of the victims were British, but 15 innocent Jews also died, proving that radical Zionists are capable of even killing fellow Jews in order to advance their cause. The Ergun terror gang also targeted Arab civilians in order to frighten them into evacuating their land. The most well-known of these massacres happened at the village of Deir Yassin on the morning of April 9, 1948. More than 100 Arabs, including women and children, were systematically slaughtered by Menachem Begin's murderous gang. The Israelis took over whatever villages the terrorized Arabs fled from. By 1948, the British had had enough of Palestine. Under intense Zionist lobbying, the UN, the UK, and the US recognized the Nation of Israel in 1948. One of the first acts of the new Israeli government was to pass the Law of Return, which gives any Jew in the world the right to move to Israel and become a citizen. Understandably, the Arab nations weren't too pleased about this. There would be several wars that followed. But the Israelis and their free arsenal of America's finest weapons kept the Arabs from reclaiming their land. The Arabs have never been a match for the U.S.-supplied Israeli war machine. The irony of the Law of Return is that many of today's Jews have no direct ancestral link to the Jews of the Old Testament. Many, perhaps even most Jewish people are descended from the Khazars, a people whose rulers converted to Judaism sometime during the 800s AD. The Khazars never even set foot in Palestine. The brutal and criminal circumstances surrounding the creation of Israel are now a half century in the past. Even most Arabs understand that Israel isn't going to go away. But by reviewing this real history, we can better understand the deceptive, dangerous, and brutal nature of Zionism today. We have reviewed how the Zionists used and discarded Germany. Then they used and discarded Great Britain. After World War II, it was clear that the chief remaining global power was the United States. Now the USA had never had any problem with the Arab people, and had no reason to quarrel with the Arabs. For the Zionists to maintain and expand the support they were receiving from America, It would benefit them greatly if the Arabs and the mighty U.S. could somehow become enemies. Could the Zionists possibly stoop so low? Why not? Look at what they had already pulled off. Remember that the official motto of the Mossad, Israel's intelligence organization, is by way of deception thou shalt do war. In 1955, one of these false flag operations was publicly exposed for the world to see. Israeli agents impersonating Arab terrorists were caught staging a series of bombings against American installations in Egypt. When this conspiracy was exposed, it ultimately created such a controversy that it brought down the Israeli government. The long-since-forgotten scandal became known as the Levant Affair. Then again during a 1967 war with the Arabs, Israeli gunboats and fighter jets deliberately attacked the USS Liberty, an unarmed U.S. communications ship. 35 American sailors were murdered and 170 others injured in a prolonged Israeli onslaught, carried out in broad daylight and with the U.S. flag flying prominently. The intent was to kill all of the Americans and then leave the Egyptians to take the blame. Israel denied that the attack was deliberate, but the chilling stories of the lucky American survivors clearly contradicts that lie. To this very day, the U.S. Congress has never investigated the USS Liberty massacre. In 1989, the Israelis once again succeeded in framing enemy Arabs in order to enrage America. Former Mossad case officer Victor Ostrovsky became so disgusted with the criminal behavior of his own government that he defected from the Mossad and tried to warn America of just how evil and dangerous they were. Ostrovsky revealed exactly how the Israelis framed Libya for the bombing of a German nightclub which killed American servicemen. It was this frame-up job that caused President Reagan to bomb Libya, killing the 4-year-old daughter of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. France refused to allow U.S. bombers to fly over their airspace and bomb Libya. Because French intelligence knew that Libya was unjustly framed by the Israelis. Among some of Ostrovsky's other amazing revelations are that the Mossad often uses Arab agents to carry out missions, that Israeli agents are skilled at impersonating Arabs, that Mossad had a plan to turn American public opinion against Iraq, and that wealthy Zionists in America are often called upon to help carry out Mossad missions. Ostrovsky, whose tell-all book, By Way of Deception, infuriated the Mossad and made him the target of numerous death threats. In 2001, the Washington Times ran a story about a 68-page research paper issued by the Army School of Advanced Military Studies, SAMS. The research was compiled by 60 U.S. Army officers as an attempt to predict the possible outcomes of deploying a U.S. force to maintain peace between the Israel and Palestinians. Here's what SAMS had to say about the Israeli military machine, a 500-pound gorilla in Israel. Well-armed and trained. Operates in both Gaza and the West Bank. Known to disregard international law, to accomplish mission of Israel's Mossad, the officers issued this warning, wild card. Ruthless and cunning. Has capability to target U.S. forces and make it look like a Palestinian Arab act. Why does the U.S., which is trillions of dollars in debt, gives away billions of taxpayer dollars to a foreign government, whose military violates international laws, and whose Mossad is capable of murdering U.S. troops in order to frame Arabs? Have we lost our minds? Now that we have established the ruthless and criminal nature of radical Zionism, one more lesson needs to be understood before we return to the five dancing Israelis of 9-11 and other related stories. Even the Zionists themselves have never denied that they have long exerted great influence in America. But what we must understand is that the Zionists do not merely influence United States policy, they dominate it. It is this domination that enables them to pull off monstrous crimes and then conceal them from the general public. The observation that Zionists dominate the American media, government, academia, and Hollywood has been made by many prominent Americans and is easily verifiable by public information. Henry Ford said, "This, if after having elected their man or group, obedience is not rendered to the Jewish control, then you speedily hear of scandals and investigations and impeachments for the removal of the disobedient." Usually a man with a past proves the most obedient instrument, but even a good man can often be tangled up in campaign practices that compromise him. It has been commonly known that Jewish manipulation of American election campaigns have been so skillfully handled that no matter which candidate was elected, there was ready-made a sufficient amount of evidence to discredit him in case his Jewish masters needed to discredit him. Charles Lindbergh said, "This, their greatest danger to this country lies in the Jewish ownership and influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government." Admiral Thomas Moorer, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff under Ronald Reagan, said this, "I've never seen a president, I don't care who he is, stand up to them, the Israelis. It just boggles the mind. They always get what they want. The Israelis know what is going on all the time. If the American people understood what a grip those people have got on our government, they would rise up in arms. Our citizens certainly don't have any idea what goes on." While a guest on ABC's Face the Nation, William Fulbright, U.S. Senator and Chairman of the U.S. Foreign Relations Committee, said this before a national television audience, "Israel controls the United States Senate. We should be more concerned about the United States' interests." Nationally syndicated columnist and former presidential candidate Patrick Buchanan said, "The United States Congress is Israeli-occupied territory." And U.S. religious leader Billy Graham and President Richard Nixon once had the following exchange, which was caught on tape: "Graham, the Jewish stranglehold on the media has got to be broken, or this country's going down the drain." Nixon, "You believe that?" Graham, "Yes, sir." Nixon, "Oh boy. So do I. I can't ever say that, but I do believe it." But enough of quoting others. Let's look at the facts of Zionist control. Fact: ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, UPN, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Daily News, Time Magazine, Newsweek, People Magazine, U.S. News, and World Report, and countless other media and Hollywood companies all have either a Zionist CEO, a Zionist news chief, or our own biomedia conglomerate which has a Zionist CEO. Have you ever noticed how Hollywood movies always seem to portray Germans and Arabs as a bigoted fanatics or as terrorists? Now you know why. Fact: AIPAC, the Israeli lobbying organization, is the most feared lobby in Washington, D.C. by their own admission. They are capable of unseating congressmen and senators that do not carry out their requests. The majority of congressmen from both political parties receive large donations from AIPAC. Writing for The Nation magazine, journalist Michael Massing explains, AIPAC is widely regarded as the most powerful foreign policy lobby in Washington. Its 60,000 members shower millions of dollars on hundreds of members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. Newspapers like The New York Times fear the Jewish lobby organizations as well. "It's very intimidating," said a correspondent at another large daily. "The pressure from these groups is relentless." Fact: the Pentagon is under the control of a hardcore Zionist named Richard Perle. The Civilian Defense Policy Board actually wields more control over the military establishment than the Defense Secretary or the generals and admirals. There are a number of other Zionists who serve on the board: Kissinger, Cohen, Schlesinger, as well as non-Jewish members who have always supported Israel and the expansion of the war on terror. The notoriously belligerent Perle, nicknamed the Prince of Darkness, is chairman of the board. With Perle as chairman of the Defense Policy Board, Zionist Paul Wolfowitz as Undersecretary of Defense, and Zionist award winner Douglas Feith as Undersecretary of Defense Policy, the Zionist Pentagon gang controls three of the top four civilian leadership positions of America's armed forces. Career scoundrels like Quando Leazar Ice and Donald Rumsfeld are either under their influence or unwilling to oppose their drive for WW3. The Perle-Wolfowitz Feith gang represent a fanatical and warmongering government within a government. In league with these Zionist Pentagon conspirators are Jewish Zionist and potential 2004 presidential candidate Senator Joseph Lieberman, DCT, and his Gentile partner in crime Senator John McCain, of Arizona. An Israeli journalist named Ari Shavit, lamenting the harsh treatments that his government dishes out to the Palestinians, made the following observation in Haaretz, a leading Israeli journal: "We believe with absolute certitude that now, with the White House and Senate in our hands along with the Pentagon and the New York Times, the lives of Arabs do not count as much as our own. Their blood does not count as much as our blood. We believe with absolute certitude that now, when we have AIPAC, the Israel Lobby, and Edgar Bronfman, and the Anti-Defamation League, we truly have the right to tell 400,000 people that in 8 hours they must flee from their homes, and that we have the right to rain bombs on their villages and towns and populated areas, that we have the right to kill without any guilt. And this only scratches the surface of Zionist power. With such awesome power to control and cover up events, is it any wonder why so many of America's journalists and politicians are afraid to even talk about this issue? Is it any wonder why former President Bill Clinton would grovel before a Jewish audience and say something as ridiculous as the following statement? The Israelis know that if the Iraqi or the Iranian army came across the Jordan River, I would personally grab the rifle, get in a ditch, and fight, and die. I could go on and on at much greater length about this subject, but I want to get back to the dancing Israelis. Have I made my point yet? I know. I know. You want to return to the scene of the dancing Israelis on 9/11. But there is one more quick lesson that needs to be covered before we climb back into the time machine and fast forward back to 9/11. If we don't cover this, you won't be able to fully understand the big picture. During the 1967 war, Israel occupied the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and Gaza. 35 years have passed since that war ended, yet the Israeli army continues the humiliating occupation of those Palestinian areas. Those areas are not part of the nation of Israel that was created in 1948 by the UN. What the Palestinian people are resisting today is not the 1948 confiscation of their land. They simply want the 1967 occupation too, and it is this ongoing occupation, not the 1948 creation of Israel, which fuels the conflict today. Prior to the current outbreak of hostilities, the majority of the Israeli people also supported the end of Israel's occupation and oppression of these territories. They elected Yitzhak Rabin as prime minister, and Rabin made more strides towards achieving peace than any of his predecessors. The 1990s were a quiet years in Israel. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Prime Minister Rabin appeared to have finally reached a peace deal, the U.S. acting as the mediator. This did not sit well with the hardcore Zionists, who ultimately hoped to expand Israel's borders even more. Hopes for a lasting peace deal were soon dealt a major setback when a flurry of 5 bullets were pumped into Prime Minister Rabin at close range, as he was attending a 1995 Israeli peace rally. It was not an Arab that killed Rabin. It was a Zionist fanatic named Yigal Amir. Amir was a law student at Israel's Bar-Ilan University. He later told investigators that he had no regrets for his actions. Amir, a bright young law student, was willing to throw his life away in the service of the Zionist cause. More on that concept later on. At the head of the Israeli government today sits a brutal man, who has been a guest of honor at George Bush's White House on a regular basis since he took office in October 2000. His name is Ariel Sharon. His fanatical Zionist supporters in Israel refer to him as Arab King, but the Arabs know him as a lifelong butcher, terrorist, and war criminal. There was a time when Sharon was disgraced and his political career seemed to be over. The isolation of Ariel Sharon was the result of a 1982 Palestinian massacre which Sharon engineered when he was Israel's defense minister. It was the Israelis themselves who forced Sharon to resign. Sharon's troops blocked the exits from the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps, while a Lebanese militia, allied with the Israeli military, went into the camps and slaughtered more than 1,500 unarmed Palestinian civilians while raping many women. Though these Lebanese militias were the ones who did the actual killing, it was Ariel Sharon who controlled the militias, and it was Sharon's soldiers who stood by and blocked the camp exits, deliberately allowing the slaughter to take place. A survivor of the attack, who had been raped and shot, went to Belgium and initiated a war crimes case against Sharon. Several Lebanese militia leaders were summoned to testify against Sharon. Shortly before their testimony, 3 of them were suddenly killed by unknown gunmen and car bombs. Israel's Mossad, of course, denied any responsibility for the strange and untimely deaths of these 3 witnesses against Sharon. And if you believe that one, I'll sell you the World Trade Center. After nearly 20 years of political exile, Sharon made his comeback in October 2000. Knowing full well how much the Palestinians hated him for his role in the 1982 massacres, Sharon and a small army of Israeli soldiers showed up at the Temple Mount, a site held sacred by both Muslims and Jews. This was a deliberate provocation. When the Muslims protested the Sharon provocation, the Israeli troops cracked down. Rocks were thrown and shots were fired. In just a matter of minutes, years of peace and the Israeli Arab peace effort had been destroyed by Mr. Sharon's bullying antics. When the fighting broke out, a frightened and propagandized Israeli population soon turned to a strong man for their protection, the very man who had deliberately instigated the violence in the first place. Ariel Sharon was elected prime minister. True to form, Sharon has brutalized the Palestinian civilian population under the pretext of self-defense. Armed and funded by Israel's wholly owned U.S. Congress, the Israeli war machine can bulldoze Arab homes at will. The only weapon that the outgunned Palestinians can retaliate with is the suicide bomber. With every suicide bombing, Sharon is able to justify even more attacks and occupy more land. The Zionist game plan is to ultimately drive the Palestinians out of the West Bank and Gaza, just like the Erdogan massacres had driven the Arabs out of Deir Yassin. Standing in the way of such a bold Zionist scheme were three major obstacles. 1. The force of world opinion. Prior to 9/11, the Palestinian struggle against Israeli occupation had gained the sympathy of many people around the world. 2. The force of Israeli domestic opinion. Most Israelis wanted peace and were opposed to the 35-year occupation of Palestinian territories. 3. Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which had always been a champion of the cause of Palestinian self-determination. How useful it would be for the Zionists if some incident were to happen which would turn American and world opinion against the Palestinians and ultimately drag the U.S. into a war against Israel's Arab enemies. Now you know why those Israelis were celebrating on 9/11. The days and hours leading up to 9/11 were marked by a series of chilling warnings about impending terrorist plots involving hijacked commercial airplanes. It's worth mentioning at this point that months before 9/11, the U.S. had already informed some of its allies of plans to go to war in Afghanistan. On June 26, 2001, News Insight / India Reacts, an Indian public affairs magazine, wrote, India and Iran will facilitate U.S. and Russian plans for limited military action against the Taliban if the contemplated tough new economic sanctions don't bend Afghanistan's fundamentalist regime. Indian officials say that India and Iran will only play the role of facilitator, while the U.S. and Russia will combat the Taliban from the front with the help of two Central Asian countries, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, to push Taliban lines back to the 1998 position 50 kilometers away from Mazar-e-Sharif city in northern Afghanistan. Military action will be the last option, though it now seems scarcely avoidable with the in-band from Taliban-controlled areas. The story of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan was reported months before 9/11 in Indian and British publications, but it was never reported in the U.S. media. With the military plans already in motion since at least June of 2001, all that was needed was for an incident to take place to justify the U.S. going to war against terrorism in Afghanistan. Here are just a few of the advance warnings which were brought to light in the aftermath of 9/11. The London Daily Telegraph reported on September 16, 2001. The Telegraph has learned that two senior experts with Mossad, the Israeli military intelligence service, were sent to Washington in August to alert the FBI and CIA to the existence of a cell of as many as 200 terrorists said to be preparing a big operation. They had no specific information about what was being planned but linked the plot to Osama bin Laden and told American officials that there were strong grounds for suspecting Iraqi involvement. Do you smell a false flag operation in the works? How is possible that the Mossad knew of the existence of these 200 terrorists but could not name or locate a single one? And how convenient for Israel that Saddam Hussein should be in cahoots with Osama bin Laden, despite the fact that bin Laden and Hussein hate each other. The Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, FAZ, one of Germany's most respected newspapers, quoted German intelligence sources, who said that the Echelon electronic spy network gave U.S. and Israeli intelligence agencies several warnings that suicidal hijack attacks were being planned against U.S. targets. Echelon is capable of monitoring all of the electronic communication in the world. Utilizing 120 satellites, the Echelon system is designed to suck up enormous amounts of data by using keyword search techniques to sift through the data. The San Francisco Chronicle reported on September 12 that San Francisco Mayor and former California Assembly Speaker Willie Brown was advised 8 hours before the attacks that he should be careful about flying on 9/11. In its September 24, 2001 issue, Newsweek magazine broke this startling revelation. 3 weeks ago there was another warning that a terrorist strike might be imminent. On September 10, Newsweek has learned, a group of top Pentagon officials suddenly canceled travel plans for the next morning, apparently because of security concerns. Well, could these unnamed top Pentagon officials have been some of the Zionist directors of the Defense Policy Board which we talked about earlier? If these Pentagon officials were scared enough not to fly, then why didn't the Pentagon place the Air Force on full alert? How could they have been so slow to react to 9/11 when they already knew there was a threat? On September 27, the Washington Post reported that two workers of the Israeli company Adigo, with offices also in New York, received instant message warnings just 2 hours before the attacks. Here's an excerpt from the Washington Post. Officials at instant messaging firm Adigo confirmed today that two employees received text messages warning of an attack on the World Trade Center 2 hours before terrorists crashed planes into the New York landmarks. Soon after the attacks, the Adigo employees informed the management of the electronic message they had received. Israeli security services were contacted, and the FBI was informed. Nothing has been heard about this event since. I think it's safe to say that Islamic terrorists would not have been considerate enough to send detailed email warnings to some obscure Israeli office workers. Let us review what we have learned. We have clearly established that Zionists played a key role in steering the U.S. into two world wars. We have clearly established that Zionists do not care if Americans or others are killed to further their goals. We have clearly established that Zionists have a record of attacking Americans in order to frame Arabs. We have established that the Zionists are capable of acts of unspeakable brutality and genocide. We have established that U.S. politicians fear the Zionist mafia and defy them at their own peril. We have learned that warnings of a suicidal hijacking plot were issued to several people. And most importantly of all, we have clearly established that the Zionists have the capacity to make these amazing stories suddenly disappear from their controlled news media. Having established these precedents, we can now easily deduce that the reason why those five dancing Israeli agents who celebrated the 9/11 attacks were so happy is because they knew that Americans would now become unconditional supporters of their Israeli ally and fanatical haters of Muslims and Arabs. On the day of the attacks, former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was asked what the attack would mean for us Israeli relations. His quick reply was, "It's very good." Well, it's not good, but it will generate immediate sympathy for Israel. The five Israelis made such a spectacle that everyone who saw them felt compelled to call the police. According to ABC's 20/20, when the van belonging to the cheering Israelis was stopped by the police, the first words out of the driver's Seven Kurtzberg lying mouth were, "We are Israelis. We are not your problem. Your problems are our problems. The Palestinians are your problem." The police and FBI field agents became really suspicious when they found box cutters, the same items that the hijackers supposedly used, $4,700 cash stuffed in a sock, and foreign passports. Police also told the Bergen Record that bomb-sniffing dogs were brought to the van, and that they reacted as if they had smelled explosives. From there, the story becomes even more suspicious. The Israelis worked for a Weehawken moving company known as Urban Moving Systems. An American employee of Urban Moving Systems told the Bergen Record that a majority of his co-workers were Israelis, and they were all joking about the attacks. The employee, who declined to give his name, said, "I was in tears. These guys were joking, and that bothered me. A few days after the attacks, Urban Moving Systems Israeli owner, Dominic Suter, dropped his business and fled the country. He was in such a hurry to flee America that some of Urban Moving Systems' customers were left with their furniture stuck in storage facilities. The five Israeli Army veterans, Mossad, were held in custody for several months before being quietly released. Some of the movers had been kept in solitary confinement for 40 days. Immediately following the attacks, the Zionist-controlled media was filled with stories linking the attacks to Bin Laden. TV talking heads and scribblers of every stripe spoon-fed a gullible American public a steady diet of the most outrageous propaganda imaginable. We were told that the reason Bin Laden attacked the USA was because he hates our free demand democracy. The Muslims were medieval, and they wanted to destroy us because of our wealth. But Bin Laden strongly denied any role in the attacks and suggested that Zionists orchestrated the 9/11 attacks. I was not involved in the September 11th attacks in the United States, nor did I have knowledge of the attacks. There exists a government within the United States. The United States should try to trace the perpetrators of these attacks within itself, to the people who want to make the present century a century of conflict between Islam and Christianity. That secret government must be asked as to who carried out the attacks. The American system is totally in control of the Jews, whose first priority is Israel, not the United States. To date, the only shred of evidence to be uncovered against Bin Laden was a highly suspicious, barely audible amateur video that the Zionist-dominated Pentagon just happened to find lying around in Afghanistan. Though there is no evidence, be it hard or circumstantial, to link the Al-Qaeda terrorist network to these acts of terror, there is in fact a mountain of evidence, both hard and circumstantial, which suggests that the Zionist mafia has been very busy framing Arabs for terror plots against America. Hours after the 9/11 attacks, authorities began to find clues conveniently left for them to stumble upon. The Boston Globe reported that a copy of the Quran, instructions on how to fly a commercial airplane, and a fuel consumption calculator were found in a pair of bags meant for one of the hijacked flights that left from Logan. Authorities also received a tip about a suspicious white car left behind at Boston's Logan Airport. An Arabic language flight trading manual was found inside the car. How fortunate for investigators that the hijackers forgot to take their Quran and Arab flight manuals with them. Within a few days, all 19 hijackers were identified, and their faces were plastered all over our television screens. Then, like a script from a corny B-spy movie, the official story gets even more ridiculous. The passport of the supposed ringleader Mohammed Atta somehow managed to survive the explosion, inferno, and smoldering collapse to be also conveniently found just a few blocks away from the World Trade Center. It is obvious that this evidence was planted by individuals wishing to direct the blame towards Osama bin Laden. How is it possible that Arab students, who had never flown an airplane, could take a simulator course and then fly jumbo jets with the skill and precision of Top Gun pilots? It is not possible, and the fact is, the true identities of the 9/11 hijackers remains a mystery. In the days following the disclosure of the hijackers' names and faces, no less than 7 of the Arab individuals named came forward to protest their obvious innocence. That's right. 7 of the 19 hijackers are alive and well. They were victims of identity theft, some of whom had had their passports stolen. They were interviewed by several news organizations, including The Telegraph of England. Here's an excerpt from David Harrison's Telegraph story entitled, Revealed, The Men with Stolen Identities. Their names were flashed around the world as suicide hijackers who carried out the attacks on America. But yesterday, 4 innocent men told how their identities had been stolen. The men, all from Saudi Arabia, spoke of their shock at being mistakenly named by the FBI as suicide terrorists. None of the 4 was in the United States on September 11th, and all are alive in their home country. The Telegraph obtained the first interviews with the men since they learned that they were on the FBI's list of hijackers who died in the crashes in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. All 4 said that they were outraged to be identified as terrorists. One has never been to America, and another is a Saudi Airlines pilot who was on a trading course in Tunisia at the time of the attacks. Saudi Airlines said it was considering legal action against the FBI for seriously damaging its reputation and that of its pilots. Emphasis added, the story of these identity thefts was also briefly reported by ABC and BBC. England, the FBI does not deny this. Nobody denies this fact because it is easily verifiable. Instead, the US media and government just ignore this inconvenient little fact and keep right on repeating the monstrous lie that the hijacker identities are known and that 15 of them were Saudis. CNN revealed that FBI Director Robert Mueller openly admitted that some of the identities of the 9 to 11 hijackers are in question due to identity theft. Here's what CNN reported on September 21. FBI Director Robert Mueller has acknowledged that some of those behind last week's terror attacks may have stolen the identification of other people, and, according to at least one security expert, it may have been relatively easy based on their level of sophistication. This opens up the whole Pandora's box of unanswered questions. First and foremost of which is this: why would Osama bin Laden, the Saudi Arabian caveman, steal identities? To cover his tracks, you say? Next question: why would a Saudi Arabian, attempting to cover his tracks, steal the identities of fellow Saudi Arabians? What would be the point? Why go you through the trouble of stealing identities that would point back to you? Why not steal Greek identities, or Brazilian identities, or Turkish ones? A much more logical conclusion is that non-Arabs stole these identities as part of a false flag operation designed to point the blame at Arabs, and Saudi Arabs in particular. What kind of a corrupt character is FBI boss Mueller? He initially admitted that false identities were involved with 9/11, but then he allows the media to keep naming these innocent and alive Arabs as the hijackers. Why doesn't he correct them? More on the slimy Mr. Mueller later on. Now I'm really going to rock your faith in the false religion of 9/11. In February of 2000, Indian intelligence officials detained 11 members of what they thought was an Al-Qaeda hijacking conspiracy. It was then discovered that these 11 Muslim preachers were all Israeli nationals. India's leading weekly magazine, The Week, reported, on January 12, Indian intelligence officials in Calcutta detained 11 foreign nationals for interrogation before they were to board a Dhaka-bound Bangladesh by manned flight. They were detained on the suspicion of being hijackers. But we realized that they were Tablighis, Islamic preachers, so we let them go, said an intelligence official. The 11 had Israeli passports, but were believed to be Afghan nationals who had spent a while in Iran. Indian intelligence officials, too, were surprised by the nationality profile of the 11. They say that they have been on Tablighi preaching Islam in India for 2 months. But they are Israeli nationals from the West Bank, said a central intelligence official. He claimed that Tel Aviv exerted considerable pressure on Delhi to secure their release. It appeared that they could be working for a sensitive organization in Israel and were on a mission to Bangladesh, the official said. What were these 11 Israelis doing trying to impersonate Al-Qaeda men? Infiltrating, perhaps? Framing, more likely. But the important precedent to understand is this: Israeli agents were once caught red-handed impersonating Muslim hijackers. This event becomes even more mind-boggling when we learn that it was Indian intelligence that helped the US to so quickly identify the 19 hijackers. On April 3, 2002, Express India, quoting the Press Trust of India, revealed, Washington, April 3, Indian intelligence agencies helped the U.S. to identify the hijackers who carried out the deadly September 11th terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, a media report said here on Wednesday. Ain't that a kick in the ass? Did you catch that? The Indian intelligence officials that were duped into mistaking Israeli agents for Al-Qaeda hijackers back in 2000 were the very same clowns telling the FBI who it was that hijacked the 9/11 planes. Keep in mind that Indian intelligence has an extremely close working relationship with Israel's Mossad, because both governments hate the Muslim nation of Pakistan. Now about Mohammed Atta, you know, the so-called ringleader. There are a number of inconsistencies with that story as well. Like some of the 7 hijackers known to be still alive, Atta also had his passport stolen in 1999, the same passport that miraculously survived the WTC explosion and collapse. making him an easy mark for an identity theft. Attar was known to all as a shy, timid, and sheltered young man, who was uncomfortable with women. The 5'7", 150-pound architecture student was such a goody-two-shoes that some of his university acquaintances in Germany refrained from drinking or cursing in front of him. How this gentle, non-political mama's boy from a good Egyptian family suddenly transformed himself into the vodka-drinking, go-go girl-groping terrorist animal described by the media has to rank as the greatest personality change since another classic work of fiction, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Attar, or someone using it as identity, had enrolled in a Florida flight school in 2001 and then broke off his training, making it a point to tell his instructor he was leaving for Boston. In an October 2001 interview with an ABC affiliate in Florida, flight school president Rudy Decker said that his course does not qualify pilots to fly commercial jumbo jets. He also described Attar as an asshole. Part of the reason for Decker's dislike for Attar stems from a highly unusual incident that occurred at the beginning of the course. Here's the exchange between ABC producer Quentin McDermott and Decker's MCDERMOTT, why do you say Attar was an asshole? Decker's, well, when Attar was here, and I saw his face on several occasions in the building, then I know that they're regular students, and then I try to talk to them. It's kind of a Puerto Rico, where are you from? I tried to communicate with him. I found out from my people that he lived in Hamburg, and he spoke German, so one of the days that I saw him, I speak German myself, I'm a Dutch citizen, and I started in the morning telling him in German, good morning. How are you? How do you like the coffee? Are you happy here? And he looked at me with cold eyes, didn't react at all and walked away. That was one of my first meetings I had. This is eerily similar to the way in which Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, became belligerent when his Minnesota flight instructor tried to speak to him in French, his first language, at the beginning of that course. The Minnesota Star Tribune reported on December 21, 2001, Moussaoui first raised eyebrows when, during a simple introductory exchange, he said he was from France but then didn't seem to understand when the instructor spoke French to him. Moussaoui then became belligerent and evasive about his background, congressman, Oberstar, and other sources said. In addition, he seemed inept in basic flying procedure while seeking expensive training on an advanced commercial jet simulator. It truly is an amazing twist of fate that both Attar and Moussaoui both had American flight instructors who spoke German and French respectively. Even the great Mossad could not have foreseen such a coincidence. The real Attar would have been able to respond to his instructor's German small talk, and the real Moussaoui would have been able to respond to his instructor's French small talk. Attar just walked away and Moussaoui threw a fit. Neither responded, because neither could. They were imposters, whose faces were probably disguised by a makeup artist. Their mission was to frame the two innocent Arabs, who were probably targeted by the Mossad at random. The imposter was able to create a new Attar by using Attar's stolen passport from 1999, the same passport that floated safely to the ground with a few burnt edges on 9/11. These strange inconsistencies tend to give support to Mohammed Attar's father's claim that he spoke over the phone with his son on September 12th, the day after the attacks. Could a group of professionals have abducted and killed the real Attar in the days following the 9/11 attacks? Mossad agents, posing as art students, were arrested after conducting some type of operation in Hollywood, Florida, the same small town that Attar stayed in. So what happened to the real Mohammed Attar? To quote his grief-stricken father, ask Mossad. So who, if not the 19 Arabs, was on those planes? That's the million-dollar question. There are a number of alternative scenarios. Could some Israelis have been fanatical enough to have volunteered for such a suicide mission? Odd as that may sound at first, it is not out of the realm of possibility. The fact is, hardcore Zionist extremists have proven themselves to be every bit as fanatical, more so, than Arab extremists. A nation which can produce thousands of bloodthirsty Zionist extremists, Afghan war criminals, Mossad terrorists, who blow up occupied buildings, assassins, who kill Israeli prime ministers, in full view of policemen, and crazed killers, who have carried sickening massacres of Arab women and children, would surely be capable of recruiting a few fanatics willing to sacrifice for the cause. This theory becomes even more plausible when we consider that only the pilots would have needed to know that the planes were on a suicide mission. Still, don't you think Israel is capable of producing suicidal terrorists? Have you already forgotten the case of Dr. Baruch Goldstein? Goldstein was a New York doctor and resettled in Israel. On February 25, 1994, Goldstein walked into a crowded Arab mosque in the occupied West Bank. With hundreds of worshippers kneeled in silent prayer, Goldstein sealed off the exit and opened fire with a rapid-firing assault rifle, killing 29 and wounding many more. Goldstein, a father of four, was finally stopped and killed when the frenzied crowd overpowered him. With as many as 800 worshippers packed into the mosque, Goldstein surely could not have been expecting to come out alive. This was clearly a suicide attack. And what did Goldstein's mother have to say about her son's suicide attack? The Boston Globe revealed the mother of Baruch Goldstein, the Jewish settler, who massacred about 40 Palestinians in a Hebron mosque a week ago, says she is proud of her son. "I always thought to myself, when would someone get up and do such a thing? And in the end, my son did it," Miriam Goldstein told the weekly Shishi newspaper. It gets even more sickening than that. Baruch Goldstein has become a folk hero among many of the crazed sidewalk settlers who have encroached upon the West Bank. They have turned Goldstein's gravesite into a memorial and set up a website to honor his murderous deed. Look what these fanatics posted on the Goldstein Memorial website. Over the years, the grave has become a site of pilgrimage. Numerous people from all over the world come to pray and honor his, Baruch's, memory. Emphasis added, one has to wonder if some of Goldstein's admirers were flying those planes on 9/11. There is one interesting side note here which may or may not be of any significance. One of the two Israelis who died aboard the hijacked planes was Daniel Lewin, who was aboard the first plane to crash into the Twin Towers. The Haaretz News Service of Israel revealed that Lewin was a one-time officer in the Israeli Defense Forces Elite Sayeret Matkal Commando Unit. Oddly enough, Lewin's name is missing from CNN's comprehensive September 11th memorial website. Another possibility is that some other group of patsies was recruited for the operation. Perhaps some anarchists, or some leftover Marxists, who thought they were going to bring down Western capitalism. Or perhaps the hijackers were another group of angry Arabs who weren't even aware of who their true handlers really were, or what the broader strategic aim of the mission actually was. In the dark world of covert operations, agents are often kept ignorant of who it is that orchestrating the show. Admittedly, these scenarios are speculative, but one thing that is not speculative is this: the hijackers were not the 19 men whose faces were shown on our TV screens. On October 26, 1999, the famous golfer Payne Stewart boarded a private Learjet in Florida and left for Texas shortly after takeoff. Stewart's jet veered sharply off course and began heading northwest. All contact with their controllers was lost. Within 15 minutes of having gone off course, U.S. fighter jets had already intercepted the jet. Everyone on board was likely dead due to depressurization. These fighter jets were dispatched by NORAD, the branch of the U.S. Air Force, whose job it is to monitor and defend U.S. airspace 24 hours a day. NORAD maintains a huge array of land-based radar systems and has fighter jets on alert 24 hours a day so that they can respond to a crisis. The jets escorted the doomed airplane until another group of their National Guard jets took over the escort mission. Finally, Stewart's jet ran out of fuel and crashed in South Dakota. The quick reaction time and military precision with which NORAD intercepted and escorted Stewart's jet was impressive and exactly what one would have expected from the greatest military power in world history. But on 9/11, the same NORAD which has so effortlessly intercepted Stewart's jet in 1999 was nowhere to be found during that two-hour period between the first planes going off course and the last one crashing in a Pennsylvania field. How is it possible that the airspace between Boston and Washington, D.C., an area which contains the political and economic heart of the nation, was left completely defenseless? The second plane to hit the New York had flown off course without communication for 40 minutes. On its way to New York, It actually flew within a few miles of McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey after the first tower had already been hit. And how is it possible that Washington, D.C. was left undefended long after the New York attacks when Andrews Air Force Base is within car driving distance? The Air Force jets which did finally arrive were too late. Was this due to NORAD's incompetence, or was the order to scramble the fighter jets deliberately delayed so that the terror attacks could take place? Given NORAD's impressive performance in the 1999 Payne's Tour disaster, this would suggest that someone high up in the Air Force establishment may have issued stand-down orders to some of our Air Force bases. Remember, the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board is headed by Zionist Richard Perle and his gang of warmongering lackeys. The civilians on this board wield the power to promote career-minded generals and admirals. Is it really that hard to believe that a highly placed military leader could have collaborated with the true 9-11 planners? What makes the Air Force's slow response even more outrageous and suspicious is that previously mentioned Newsweek article which revealed that several Pentagon leaders, Defense Policy Board, canceled flight plans for September 11th due to security concerns. There were other warning signals to which we re-reviewed earlier. In light of all these warnings, why wasn't NORAD and its armada of fighters placed on an even higher alert than they already are? There is only one logical answer to these questions. Certain Pentagon leaders were in on it. General Hamid Ghul, a former director of Pakistani intelligence, hit the nail on the head with his analysis: the attacks against New York and Washington were Israeli engineered. The attack started at 8:45, and four flights are diverted from their assigned airspace, and no Air Force fighter jets scramble until 10 o'clock. Radars are jammed, transponders fail, and no IFF, friend, or foe identification, challenge. In Pakistan, if there is no response to an IFF, jets are instantly scrambled. This was clearly an inside job. Will this also be hushed up in the investigation, like the Kennedy assassination? This raises another troubling set of questions. Surely the masterminds of the 9-11 operation would have taken the time to learn something about U.S. air defense procedures. They would therefore have realized that hitting New York City with jets hijacked from Boston would have been difficult. New York is about 30 minutes away by airplane, and jumbo jets fly very slowly when compared to U.S. fighter jets that can crack the sound barrier. Even with a 15-20 minute head start, NORAD's jets could have easily intercepted them, especially the second plane, which took a longer route to New York and flew way off course for 40 minutes. Why choose Boston's airport and jeopardize the success of the operation? Wouldn't it be safer to just hijack planes from New York's Kennedy or LaGuardia airports? Or even Newark, New Jersey, which is just across the river? Any plane hijacked from either of those three busy airports would have been unstoppable. Even a plane from Philadelphia's airport would have been much closer to the target than far away Boston. The planners were no dummies. They must have counted on receiving protective cover and a window of opportunity by someone high up at U.S. Air Command. Why else choose Boston? In addition to the protection that the planners were to receive from certain Air Force elements, there is another plausible theory for choosing Boston's Logan Airport as well as United and American Airlines planes. It should be noted that the firm which provides security at Boston's Logan Airport and also Newark Airport and also works extensively with United and American Airlines is a company called Huntley USA. Claiming that Huntley USA's airport security was grossly negligent on 9/11, family members of some of the victims are suing Huntley. Huntley USA had been acquired by ICTS International in 1999. ICTS is controlled by two Israelis, Ezra Harel and Menachem Atzman. In short, security at Boston's Logan Airport was handled, or mishandled, by an Israeli-controlled company. Is there a connection here? Could agents have been infiltrated into Logan Airport under Israeli-owned Huntley's cover? It's quite possible. In the days following the 9/11 attacks, Israeli security professionals began aggressively marketing themselves in order to gain more airport security jobs. Americans should be grateful to have such wonderful allies who care about our airport security so much. Could some of the failure of our defense systems be attributed to a cyber attack from computer hackers? Our defense and intelligence systems are very dependent upon technology. A well-coordinated attack on these systems may also have contributed to our inability to expose and prevent the attacks. There is one group that has the capability to attack our military computer systems. In July of 1999, Haaretz, Israel, ran a story headlined, "Hackers Using Israeli Net Site to Strike at Pentagon." Haaretz reported, "An Israeli internet site is being used by international computer hackers as a base for electronic attacks on U.S. government and military computer systems," according to Pentagon officials who were quoted in a Washington Times report yesterday. According to the Times, the real danger to U.S. national security is the threat posed by foreign intelligence services or governments that could launch electronic warfare against the United States, and look what the U.S. Department of Justice wrote in this 1998 press release. Washington, D.C., the Department of Justice, in conjunction with the FBI, the Air Force Office of Special Investigation, the National Aeronautic and Space Administration, and the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, announced today that the Israeli National Police arrested Ehud Teinbaum, an Israeli citizen, for illegally accessing computers belonging to the Israeli and United States governments, as well as hundreds of other commercial and educational systems in the United States and elsewhere. No doubt about it. Covert elements in Israel have been targeting the U.S. military as defense systems for some time now. This could very well have been yet another instrument played during the great orchestrated concert of 9/11. The government/media-approved version of events insists that the fires in the World Trade Center burned so hot that they caused steel supports to melt and buckle, thus triggering a total collapse of the towers. This is a strange theory for a number of reasons. 1. The architects who designed the World Trade Center designed it to withstand the direct impact and fuel fire of a commercial airline crash. Aaron Swirsky, one of the architects of the WTC, described the collapse as incredible and unbelievable. Lee Robertson, the project's structural engineer, said, "I designed it for a 707 to hit it. The Boeing 707 has a fuel capacity comparable to the 767. 2. The history of high-rise building fires provides no case histories of buildings collapsing due to steel beams melting from a fire. 3. The collapse of both towers were both perfectly symmetrical and methodical. The straight-down collapse was identical in appearance to a well-engineered, controlled implosion. A demolition company could not have done it better. Now that we know that all one has to do to bring a tall building straight down is set a fuel fire in it, the well-trained experts who work for demolition companies should all be out of a job by now. Even a layman with no explosives background should be able to see this. But many specialists in the explosives and structural engineering have also made this observation and commented on these inconsistencies." After the WTC collapse, the vice president of New Mexico Tech, Van Romero, gave an interview to the Albuquerque Journal. He stated plainly that he believed that the WTC collapse was too methodical and that explosive devices must have been placed in key points of both buildings. Romero said, "It would be difficult for something from the plane to trigger an event like that. It could have been a relatively small amount of explosives placed in strategic points. One of the things that terrorists are noted for is a diversionary attack and a secondary device." In that same interview, Romero revealed that he was in Washington, D.C. when the attacks took place. He and a colleague were there to discuss defense research programs for New Mexico Tech. A few days after his interview, Romero abruptly changed his opinion and told the Albuquerque Journal that he no longer believed that bombs brought down the towers. Romero, who relies upon the Zionist-occupied Pentagon for funding, had suddenly flip-flopped and joined the melted steel theorists. "There is more than just my own common sense and Romero's expert opinion to support the belief that the towers were imploded from within. Several witnesses and survivors reported hearing bombs going off inside the World Trade Center." Louis Caccioli is a firefighter with Engine 47 in Harlem, New York. Caccioli told People magazine the following, "I was taking firefighters up in the elevator to the 24th floor to get in position to evacuate workers. On the last trip up, a bomb went off. We think there were bombs set in the building." Now this whole controversy between the melted steel scenario and the detonation scenario is one that could be very easily resolved. All we have to do is dig up the steel beams and examine each and every one of them. If an explosive device caused the steel to fail, there will be telltale indications for the engineers to see. But if it was intense heat that caused the steel to melt or buckle, there will be telltale signs of that as well. All we have to do to put an end to this controversy is to closely examine the steel. Right? Well, don't hold your breath. That's never going to happen. Thanks in large part to Time Magazine's Man of the Year 2001 New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, the steel beams were quickly recycled before investigators even had the chance to look at them. A media darling and lifelong supporter of Israel, Saint Rudy Giuliani, made sure that the smoking gun evidence was destroyed, and right quick too. Much of the steel was recycled in America, but an additional 70,000 tons of WTC steel was sold to Metals Management, a New York company with a Jewish Zionist president named Alan Ratner. Ratner then turned around and shipped the WTCS steel to China and India for recycling. China Radio International's English edition also reported, New York's Metals Management is among the firms taking steel from the huge project to clear Ground Zero. The company says it has bought 70,000 tons of scrap from the ruined Twin Towers. Some of the scrap has been shipped across the Pacific to Asia, including China and India. Among the consignments of scrap are the very dense steel girders from Ground Zero, which could finally yield 250,000 to 400,000 tons of scrap for recycling. Imagine that. The largest criminal investigation in history, and the investigators weren't even permitted to see the most important evidence of all, the steel. During the time that Saint Rudy and Ratner the recycler were destroying evidence, many of the most respected engineers in the country complained not only about the recycling, but also about the federal government's suffocating control of their investigation. On December 25, 2001, the New York Times ran a story about the frustrations of some of the engineers who were called in to study the cause of the collapse, interviews with a handful of members of the team, which includes some of the nation's most respected engineers, also uncovered complaints that they had at various times been shackled with bureaucratic restrictions that prevented them from interviewing witnesses, examining the disaster site, and requesting crucial information, like recorded distress calls to the police and fire departments. They made their concerns known publicly. Bill Manning, editor of the 125-year-old Fire Engineering magazine, noticed a strange difference between the WTC investigation and other major fire investigations in New York City's history. Manning wrote, "Did they throw away the locked doors from the Triangle Shirtwaist fire? Did they throw away the gas can used at the Happy Land Social Club fire? That's what they're doing at the World Trade Center. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately." One investigator told the New York Times, "This is almost the dream team of engineers in the country working on this, and our hands are tied," said one team member, who asked not to be identified. Members have been threatened with dismissal for speaking to the press. "FEMA is controlling everything," the team member said. Dr. Frederick W. Maurer from the Fire Engineering Department at the University of Maryland told the New York Times, "I find the speed with which important evidence has been removed and recycled to be appalling." Finally, the Times story made this interesting little revelation about Saint Rudy the recycler. Officials in the mayor's office declined to reply to written and oral requests for comment over a 3-day period about who decided to recycle the steel, and the concern that the decision might be handicapping the investigation. It is a very odd form of science that the government and some of its house scientists practice these days. Without a shred of physical evidence, these modern-day alchemists have been able to prove their theory fire caused the towers to collapse. This appears to be yet another monstrous lie. "Why else would you destroy the melted steel?" asked Rudy. "Not just Americans were murdered on 9/11. Nearly 500 foreign nationals from over 80 different nations were killed in the World Trade Center. As a center of world trade and finance, this is not surprising. It is also commonly known that many Israelis work in the field of international trade and finance. The laws of probability dictate that among the nearly 500 dead foreign nationals from over 80 different nations, there should have been a considerable number of Israelis. But the number of Israeli dead was suspiciously low, especially when we consider the report contained in the September 12th Jerusalem Post that the Israeli embassy in America was bombarded on 9/11 with calls from 4,000 worried Israeli families. George Bush had told the U.S. Congress that he also mourned the deaths of foreign citizens, including more than 130 Israelis. But Bush was either misinformed or he was lying. The actual number of Israeli dead at the WTC was far less than 130. It was far less than 100. It was far less than 50. It was far less than 25. It was far less than 10. It was 0. That's right. 0 Israeli nationals lost their lives in the WTC, while citizens from over 80 different nations, including such powerhouses of world trade and finance as Grenada, Bermuda, Ireland, and the Philippines, all lost people in the WTC. One Israeli was killed aboard each of the flights that crashed into the WTC. None were killed in the WTC itself. We learned earlier about the employees of the Israeli instant messaging company at IGO, who were anonymously informed of the attacks 2 hours before they took place. Even more intriguing than the IGO warnings was the narrow escape of 200 employees of an Israeli government-run company called Zim Israel Navigational. With over 80 vessels, Zim Navigational is the ninth largest shipping company in the world. Just 1 week before 9/11, Zim Navigational moved out of its World Trade Center offices with over 200 workers. Company spokesperson Dan Adler said, "When we watched the pictures, we felt so lucky. Our entire U.S. operations were run out of the 16th floor. Zim moved to Virginia." Nadler added that the aim of the sudden move was to save on rent. Somehow the claim that a major global shipping firm, backed up by government money, needed to save a few bucks on rent lacks credibility. And oh, what perfect timing. So who tipped off Zim? Who tipped off IGO? Who tipped off those Pentagon officials? Who tipped off those Israeli workers in New York? I think it's safe to say it wasn't Osama bin Laden. Within minutes after the attack, a parade of politicians and terrorism experts appeared on every TV channel, all claiming that the attacks were the work of Osama bin Laden. The Bush administration claimed that it had evidence linking bin Laden to the attacks, which it would release to the public in a matter of days. They never did. Just like they never provided any evidence that he blew up the U.S. embassies in Africa in 1997. The entire case against Osama bin Laden was based on nothing but the repeated claim that he was the culprit for the embassy bombings and for 9/11. Demands were placed upon the Taliban government of Afghanistan to turn bin Laden over to the U.S. or face an attack. We established earlier that U.S. military action had already been planned since June. The Taliban offered to turn bin Laden over to a neutral party if the U.S. provided any evidence to them that he had anything to do with the 1997 U.S. African embassy bombings or the 9/11 attacks. The evidence was never presented to the Taliban for two reasons. 1. There was never any evidence, not even circumstantial. 2. The war to replace the Taliban with a U.S. puppet government was already in motion. The 9/11 attack served as the perfect excuse, the incident, to win the support of the American people and kick off the war. 3 months after the attacks, and with the bombing of Afghani peasants in full swing, the U.S. had still not provided one shred of evidence to link bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda network to 9/11. People in foreign countries were beginning to ask questions. Then one day, the Pentagon claimed that some unnamed source found a videotape in Afghanistan. The Bush gang began dropping hints in the media that this video shows Osama bin Laden bragging and admitting his role in the attacks. How convenient. And how improbable. The mastermind of 9/11, who was so brilliant that he pulled off 9/11 without being detected, was careless enough to leave a confession video laying around to be discovered by the U.S. The video was shown on the news with English subtitles. Bin Laden's voice was so barely audible that even viewers in Arab nations had to rely on the Pentagon's translated subtitles. An obedient American, Zionist, news media accepted the Pentagon story and translation without question. A few Arab media whores were even trotted out to vouch for the tape's authenticity. This is the smoking gun they assured us, but this too is another vicious lie. On December 20, 2001, the German TV show Monitor, the 60 Minutes of Germany, found the translation of the confession video to be not only inaccurate but even manipulative. Dr. Abdel Alem Hussaini and Professor Gernot Rotter made an independent translation and accused the White House translators of writing a lot of things that they wanted to hear but cannot be heard on the tape no matter how many times you listen to it. Even more compelling than the revelations of the European press are the actual images of the confession video. Every photo previously taken of Osama bin Laden shows odd facial features and a long thin nose. The Pentagon video of bin Laden clearly shows a man with full facial features and a wide nose. Examine the pictures side by side for yourself if you don't believe it. The differences in facial features will jump right out at you. Would the Pentagon leadership be capable of such deception? Why not? They were capable of allowing 9/11 to happen, weren't they? The Pentagon itself has even admitted the existence of a special department established for the purpose of planting false stories in the media in order to carry out strategic objectives. The very Zionist and very pro-war New York Times broke a story in February 2002 which revealed that the Pentagon has plans to deliberately provide false stories to the press as part of an effort to influence policy. The Pentagon set up the Office of Strategic Influence, OSI, for this purpose. A Zionist Air Force general named Simon P. Worden was chosen to head this criminal effort. Worden's boss is Douglas Feith, another dedicated Zionist who serves as Under Secretary of Defense for Policy. How dedicated of a Zionist is Feith? The Zionist Organization of America, ZOA, honored Feith and his father at an award dinner in 1999. So I'll let ZOA's 1997 press release you about Feith. This year's honorees will be Dolk Feith and Douglas J. Feith, the noted Jewish philanthropists and pro-Israel activists. Dolk Feith will receive the ZOA's Special Centennial Award at the dinner for his lifetime of service to Israel and the Jewish people. His son Douglas J. Feith, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, will receive the prestigious Louis D. Brandeis Award at the dinner. 121-Google-Use-Use-Enter Feith Zionist Organization Award. There you have it. The Zionist Air Force General, who runs the Pentagon's Media Disinformation Department, reports directly to a Zionist Pentagon boss, who was a recipient of the prestigious Louis Brandeis Award. Brandeis, a former Supreme Court judge, was one of the key Zionist power brokers who helped influence Woodrow Wilson into joining World War I as part of the Zionist British Balfour deal we learned about earlier. 1 year has passed since the 9/11 attacks, and the FBI has not uncovered any Al-Qaeda cells in the United States, nor has it found any paper trail. The London Times reported, thousands of FBI agents have rounded up more than 1,300 suspects across America since September 11, but they have failed to find a single Al-Qaeda cell operating in the United States. Tom Ridge, director of Homeland Security, could not explain why none had been caught. In April of 2002, FBI Director Robert Mueller, the same Robert Mueller who admitted that several hijacker identities were in doubt due to identity thefts, made this stunning announcement. In our investigation, we have not uncovered a single piece of paper, either here or in the treasure trove of information, that has turned up in Afghanistan and elsewhere, that mentioned any aspect of the September 11th plot. Predictably, Directors Ridge and Mueller attribute this total lack of any evidence to the skill of the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. If you've read this far, you should know better. The reason that the U.S. has been unable to uncover a shred of evidence to link Al-Qaeda to 9/11 is because Al-Qaeda didn't do it. The FBI's field agents are the good guys. It's the ass-kissing, spineless careerists at the top who have corrupted the agency. In the critical weeks and months leading up to that fateful day, numerous clues were picked up by loyal FBI field agents. Some of these agents were so alarmed at what they thought was an unfolding terror plot that they tried to convince their superiors to investigate deeper. These agents were either ignored, threatened, or fired. Each of these FBI agents thought that they were on the trail of an Arab terror plot, and unless they've read this paper, they probably still believe so. We can't forgive them their ignorance if they haven't realized yet that the trail they were on was not that of Arab terrorists, but rather Mossad agents impersonating Arab terrorists. Much more on that later. The essential point is that these agents were onto something big that someone didn't want them to digging into. There is FBI Special Agent Robert Wright. The public interest law firm Judicial Watch is representing Agent Wright. Wright claims that he was met with retaliation and threats from his bosses and from the Justice Department, who told him they wanted his probes to go no further. Wright maintains that if his investigation had been allowed to continue, the attacks could have been prevented. There is FBI agent Colleen Rowley. The gutsy Rowley wrote a 13-page letter to FBI Director Robert Mueller, in which she actually accuses the director of her own agency of a subtle skewing of the facts. Rowley's letter also charged that the agency refused to react to evidence of a pending terror plot. According to Rowley, the FBI's obstruction was so blatant that her and some of her fellow agents jokingly speculated that key FBI personnel must have been moles working for Osama bin Laden. Rowley's main point of contention was the agency's failure to go after Zacharias Moussaoui, the 20th hijacker, even after his flight school instructor reported his suspicious behavior to the FBI. Moussaoui, you will recall, was the French-Algerian who couldn't he speak French to his flight school instructor. There is FBI agent Sybil Edmonds. Edmonds was an FBI wiretap translator. She claims that another FBI translator was working for the Mossad, and that the Mossad also tried to recruit Edmonds to make phony translations for the purpose of misdirecting investigations. When Agent Edmonds refused, the Mossad threatened her safety. When she brought these allegations to the attention of her superiors, she was fired for being disruptive. The Washington Post briefly reported this story, without mentioning the name of nation that tried to recruit Edmonds. But the Post did reveal that Edmonds and the other translator traced their ethnicity to this certain Middle Eastern country. Agent Sybil Edmonds is not an Arab. Edmonds is Jewish. Therefore, we know that the Middle Eastern nation which the Post chose not to name is Israel. No big surprise there. Sybil Edmonds deserves a lot of credit for defying the Mossad and blowing the whistle to her superiors. Instead, she was fired for her patriotic efforts, proving once again that Zionists are willing to hurt innocent Jews. There is FBI agent John M. Cole, program manager for FBI intelligence investigations covering India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. In the same Washington Post story about Edmonds, it was reported that Cole also wrote a letter to FBI Chief Mueller warning him about lax security procedures in the hiring of translators. Dedicated agents such as Wright, Rowley, Cole, Edmonds, and others who have spoken anonymously had to be stopped from going after Muslim terrorists. If not so obstructed, they would in time come to discover that they were interiorly Al-Qaeda terrorists. Not only were investigations blocked before 9/11, but they continue to be blocked after 9/11. The cover-up is so blatant that members of both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees complains directly to CIA Director George Tenet and Attorney General John Ashcroft. The Los Angeles Times reported, lawmakers leading the investigation of intelligence failures surrounding the 9/11 attacks are increasingly concerned that the CIA and Justice Department are actively impeding their efforts. The flare-up centers on obstacles congressional investigators say the agencies have strewn in their path. That's exactly what FBI agents Wright, Rowley, Edmonds, and Cole said happened to them when they tried to investigate before the attacks. By the way, did I mention that the FBI is under the jurisdiction of yet another Zionist named Michael Chertoff? Chertoff is the director of the Criminal Division of the U.S. Justice Department. FBI Chief Robert Mueller has to answer to Chertoff. Perhaps that explains Mueller's highly pathetic and highly revealing speech before the Anti-Defamation League's 24th Annual National Leadership Conference held in May of 2002. I have long admired and respected the work of ADL, and I appreciate your long-standing support of the FBI. I know that under my predecessor, Louis Freeh, this partnership reached new heights. I am absolutely committed to building on that relationship. We in the FBI tremendously value your perspectives and your partnership. Your insights and research into extremism are particularly helpful to us, shedding light on the changing nature of the terrorist threats facing America. Your support of hate crime and terrorist investigations, which are now front and center in the work of the FBI, is essential to us, and the training and education you provide for the FBI and for law enforcement have never been more relevant. That includes the conference on extremist and terrorist threats you are sponsoring later this month at the FBI Academy. Just shoot me now. The FBI is in partnership with the Zionist ADL and relies upon this criminal smear group for insights and research and education and training. Didn't anyone ever tell FBI Chief Mueller that, when the FBI raided the California offices of the ADL in 1993, they found that the ADL had computerized files on nearly 10,000 people across the country, and that more than 75% of the information had been illegally obtained from police, FBI files and state driver's license data banks? Isn't E. Mueller aware that the San Francisco Superior Court awarded $150,000 in court judgments against the Anti-Defamation League in connection with this FBI bust? What other group in America could get away with not only stealing FBI files, a federal offense, but then becoming partners with the FBI? So why would FBI Director Mueller disregard the fact that the ADL is a criminal group that was caught spying on U.S. citizens by his own FBI? Why does Mueller ignore the insights of his own agents while thanking the criminal ADL for its advice? It's because Mueller and his kind are empty, career-minded yes-men who understand that it doesn't pay to defy the Zionist mafia. Askissers like Mueller get promoted. Honest agents like Wright, Rowley, Edmonds, and Cole go nowhere fast. On October 3, 2001, an Egyptian-American scientist named Dr. Ayad Assad sat terrified in a vault-like interrogation room at an FBI office in Washington, D.C. It was not yet known that a pair of letters containing deadly anthrax had been mailed to NBC newsman Tom Brokaw and U.S. Senator Tom Daschle. Five people would die as a result of the anthrax mailings, which had been mailed from New Jersey. Billions of pieces of mail were delayed, costing the U.S. Post Office to suffer huge losses. The news media ran nothing but anthrax stories night and day. Politicians and commentators speculated that Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein were behind the letters. Why was the FBI questioning Assad? Before the anthrax murders were committed, someone had sent the FBI an anonymous letter accusing Dr. Assad of being a bioterrorist with a grudge against the United States. The letter was sent on September 25, before the first anthrax case was even diagnosed. The FBI agents soon were convinced that the anonymous letter was a hoax and a frame-up attempt. Assad was cleared of suspicion and released. Assad later told the Hartford Courant of Connecticut, "I was so angry. When I read the letter, I broke out in tears." Whoever this person is knew in advance what was going to happen and created a suitable, well-fitted scapegoat for this action. You do not need to be a Nobel laureate to put two and two together. If we find out who would have wanted to frame Dr. Assad, in particular, and Arabs, in general, we will likely find out who was behind the anthrax murders. That the wording of the anthrax letters was contrived in such a manner as to frame Arabs/Muslims is so self-evident that even a mentally retarded child could see through it. Here is the wording of the Daschle letter: "You cannot stop us, we have this anthrax. You die now. Are you afraid? Death to America. Death to Israel. Hell is great." And the Brokaw letter: "This is next. Take penicillin now. Death to America. Death to Israel. Hell is great. Give me a break." Ask yourself, who would want to frame Arabs? Who would want to link the interests of the U.S. and the interests of Israel in the obvious way these ridiculous letters attempt to? Remember the Levon affair. Remember the USS Liberty. Remember the dancing Israelis. Remember Netanyahu saying 9/11 was good for us Israeli relations. A good place to start searching would be the U.S. bioweapons lab at Fort Detrick, MD. The AIM strain of anthrax has in fact been traced to Fort Detrick, where Assad once worked until he was laid off in 1997. After he was let go from Fort Detrick, Assad filed a federal discrimination suit based upon the brutal abuse and harassment that he had endured from some highly suspicious co-workers. In 1991, Assad found an 8-page poem in his mailbox, which became a courtroom exhibit. The poem had 235 lines, many of them lewd and sexually explicit, mocking Assad. Along with the poem, the perpetrators left Assad a rubber camel with a large penis attached to it. This was an obvious attempt to mock Assad's Arab ethnicity. Assad said that when he brought the poem to the attention of his supervisor, Colonel David Franz, Franz kicked him out of his office. 139 Now these weren't immature college kids doing this. This outrageous emotional abuse was carried out by highly trained scientists who obviously wanted Assad out. One of the scientists known to have been a leader in the horrible attacks on Dr. Assad was Dr. Lieutenant Colonel Philip Zak. Philip Zak was to voluntarily leave Fort Detrick shortly after Assad brought Zak's poem Mein Kampf to the attention of his supervisors. Strike 1 on Dr. Zak. In an indirectly related matter, another Fort Detrick researcher, Dr. Mary Beth Downs, told Army investigators that on several occasions in January and February of 1992, she had come to work several times to discover that someone had been conducting anthrax research after hours. Who could that person have been? Documents from that 1992 inquiry confirm that an unauthorized person was observed on a surveillance camera being let into the lab at 8:40 p.m. on January 23, 1992. Who was this unauthorized person caught sneaking into the bioweapons lab during the same time period that anthrax research was being done after hours? None other than Lieutenant Colonel Philip Zak. The same Zak who was forced to resign a year earlier because of his horrible abuse of Dr. Assad. Strike 2 on Dr. Zak. Why would Dr. Zak and others have such an animosity towards Dr. Assad? What would motivate him to help write a 235-line hate poem? What motive would he have to frame Arabs for the deadly anthrax murders? Well, some research into the name Zak reveals that it is a fairly common Jewish surname, derived from the Old Testament Zacharias. Dr. Zak is Jewish, and given his obvious, fanatical hatred of Arabs, we can safely deduce that he is a hardcore Zionist. Strike 3 on Dr. Zak. All of the above is public information. Assad's 1990s legal proceedings, Dr. Downs' testimony, the surveillance video of Zak sneaking into Fort Detrick 1 year after he had resigned, it's all there. The Hartford Courant exposed all of these facts, as did the Toronto Globe and Mail, the Seattle Times, and other publications. Just the facts contained in Hartford Courant's story alone should be enough to at least indict Philip Zak. So why didn't we see Dr. Zak's face on our TV screens? Why hasn't Dr. Zak been given a lie detector test? What forces in the media and the government are protecting Zak from being exposed as the logical prime suspect? The plot thickens and sickens even more. It is not my intent to smear, defame, or offend Jewish people here. But to not mention the ethnicity of certain players in this fantastic drama would be like writing an expose on the Italian mafia without mentioning that its major players are Italians. Remember, some of the Zionists' harshest critics are themselves Jewish. Dr. Assad had been cleared and Dr. Zak was coming under a small amount of media and FBI suspicion. Enter, from stage left, one Barbara Rosenberg, a Jewish environmentalist professor and political activist with no expertise in biowarfare. Rosenberg suddenly went public with the claim that she knew who the anthrax killer was. She was supported in this effort by another Zionist New York Times journalist named Nicholas D. Kristof, who openly called for the arrest of Hatfield. Quietly and behind the scenes, Rosenberg began directing investigators towards an American scientist named Dr. Stephen Hatfield, and therefore away from Dr. Zak. The Washington Post confirmed that it was Rosenberg who helped put authorities on the trail of the innocent Dr. Hatfield. The name of Hatfield trickled forth from the news media. In a matter of weeks, the trickle became a media flood. Dr. Hatfield became a household name. Hatfield called a news conference to protest his innocence. There is not a shred of evidence against him and he passed an FBI lead detector test. But the Zionist-controlled media lynch mob, led by the evil Rosenberg and the yellow journalist Kristof, continued to pursue and harass Hatfield. Dr. Hatfield may never be imprisoned, but his life and career have been destroyed by these false allegations and the media hype. Lieutenant Colonel Zak is off the hook. What these mad Zionist scientists and their media brethren have done to Dr. Assad and Dr. Hatfield is monstrous beyond belief. It is clear that these anthrax letters were first intended to be an anti-Arab frame, up with Assad meant to take the blame. When that didn't work, these fanatical Zionists, who always stick together, like glue, put the media and the FBI on poor Dr. Hatfield's back, and wrecked his career and reputation in the process? Why hasn't Dr. Zach been given an FBI lead detector test? Ask FBI boss and ADL partner Robert Mueller. We talked at length about the five Israeli movers, i.e. Mossad agents, who were arrested and placed in solitary confinement after they were caught celebrating the 9/11 horror show. We also reviewed how the Israeli owner of Urban Moving Systems, Dominic Suter, then suddenly abandoned his moving company and fled for Israel on 9/14. But there were still more Israeli movers in America whose actions raise serious suspicions. In October of 2001, three more Israeli movers were stopped in Plymouth, PA, because of their suspicious behavior. These movers were seen dumping furniture near a restaurant dumpster. When the restaurant manager approached the driver, a Middle Eastern man later identified as Moshe Elmakias fled the scene. The manager made note of the truck's sign which read Moving Systems Incorporated, and called the police. When the police spotted the truck, two other Israelis, Ila Treisler and Ron Kadar, began acting suspiciously. The Plymouth police searched the truck and found a video. The Israelis were taken into custody, and the videotape was played at the police station. The video revealed footage of Chicago, with zoomed-in shots of the Sears Tower. The police quickly alerted the FBI, and it was also discovered that the Israelis had falsified travel logs and phony paperwork on them. They were also unable to provide a name and telephone number for the customer that they claimed to have been working for. These Israelis were up to some sort of dirty business, and you can be sure it had nothing to do with moving furniture. On October 10, 2001, CNN made a brief mention of a foiled terrorist bomb plot in the Mexican Parliament building. They promised to bring any further developments of this story to their viewers, but the incident was never heard of again in America. But the story appeared in bold headlines on the front page of the major Mexican newspapers, and was also posted on the official website of the Mexican Justice Department. Two terrorist suspects were apprehended in the Mexican Chamber of Deputies. Caught red-handed, they had in their possession a high-powered gun, 9 hand grenades, and C4 plastic explosives, great stuff for demolishing buildings. Within days, this blockbuster story not only disappeared from the Mexican press, but the terrorists were released and deported. The two terrorists were Salvador Gerson Sunki and Sarb Benzui. Can you guess what their ethnicity was? Gerson Sunki was a Mexican Jew and Zui was a colonel with the Israeli Special Forces. Can you say Mossad? The story in El Diario de Mexico went on to reveal that the Zionist terrorists had fake Pakistani passports on them. Can you say false flag operation? The probable motive of this particular botched terrorist operation was to involve oil-rich Mexico in the war on terrorism. The war on Israel's enemies would be a more accurate description. Mexico is no military power, but the psychological trauma of an Arab attack on Mexico would surely have induced Mexico to provide unlimited cheap oil to her American protector. With cheap oil flowing to America at rock-bottom prices from Mexico, the U.S. could better afford to break off relations with the oil-rich Arabs, in general, and Saudi Arabia in particular. That's why the conspiracy chose so many Saudi identities to steal for the 9/11 operation. In November of 2001, six more suspicious Israelis were detained in an unspecified Mideastern state. They had in their possession box cutters, oil pipeline plans, and nuclear power plant plans. The local police called in the feds and immigration officials took over the scene and released the men without calling the FBI. The Jerusalem Post, the Miami Herald, and the Times of London all carried this amazing story, and all revealed how furious FBI officials were that these suspects with nuclear power plant plans were allowed to go free. Of course, the corruption-riddled FBI would only have caved into Zionist pressure from the Justice Department's criminal division boss, Michael Chertoff, and also from the ADL's partner FBI boss Robert Mueller, who would no doubt have found a way to release those Israeli terror suspects too. In December of 2001, the Los Angeles Times published the story of how two Jewish terrorists were arrested by the FBI for plotting to blow up the office of U.S. Congressman of Arab descent, Daryl Issa, RCA, and also a California mosque. Herb Rubin and Earl Kruger of the Radical Zionist Jewish Defense League, JDL, were charged with conspiracy to destroy a building by means of explosives. This story got brief national coverage, but quickly disappeared too. These Zionists sure love blowing up buildings and killing innocent people, don't they? In May of 2002, yet another moving van was pulled over in Oak Harbor, Washington, near the Whidbey Island Naval Air Station. Fox News reported that the van was pulled over for speeding shortly after midnight. The passengers told the police they were delivering furniture, but because it was so late at night, the police weren't buying the story. A bomb-sniffing dog was brought in and the dog detected the presence of TNT and RDX plastic explosives in the truck, great stuff for demolishing buildings. Both Fox News and the Haaretz newspaper of Israel reported that the two movers were Israelis. According to Fox News, throughout late 2000 and 2001, a total of 200 Israeli spies were arrested. It was the largest spy ring to be uncovered in the history of the U.S. The Washington Post also reported that some of these Israelis were arrested in connection with the 9/11 investigation. U.S. Carl Cameron of Fox News Channel did an excellent four-part, nationally televised, series of investigations into this blockbuster scandal. But Fox pulled the investigative series after Zionist groups complained to Fox executives. Fox even went so far as to remove the written transcripts of the series from its website. In a desk place was posted a chilling, Orwellian message which reads, "This story no longer exists." Fortunately for the sick of history, the Fox transcripts were copied onto many other websites, and all four parts are available for your review. See footnotes. The Fox series and other mainstream news media sources revealed that many of these Israelis were army veterans with electronics and explosives expertise. Many of them failed lead detector tests. FBI agents told Fox that some of their past investigations were compromised because suspects had been tipped off by Israeli wiretapping specialists. It was discovered that Israeli companies such as Comverse and Amdox have the capability to tap American telephones, great for blackmailing all those wife-cheating politicians. FBI agents also told Fox they believed the Israelis had advanced knowledge of the 9/11 attacks, which certainly would explain why no Israelis died in the WTC. Still another U.S. official informed Fox that some of the detained Israelis actually had links to 9/11, but he refused to describe the nature of those links. The FBI official told Fox's Carl Cameron, "Evidence linking these Israelis to 9/11 is classified. I cannot tell you about the evidence that has been gathered. It is classified information." Then there was that small army of Israeli art students who were arrested for trying to sneak into secured U.S. federal buildings and staking out 36 Department of Defense sites. Some of these suspicious art students even showed up at the homes of federal employees. Ron Hatchett, a Department of Defense analyst, told Channel 11, KHOU News in Houston, that he believed that the art students were gathering intelligence for future attacks. He read an excerpt from the October 1, 2001 KHOU investigative report by Anna Werner, "Could federal buildings in Houston and other cities be under surveillance by foreign groups?" That's what some experts are asking after federal law enforcement and security officials, nationally and in Houston, described for the 11 News Defenders a curious pattern of behavior by a group of people claiming to be Israeli art students. Hatchett says they could be doing what he would be doing if he were a terrorist, sizing up the situation. "We need to know what are the entrances to this particular building. We need to know what are the surveillance cameras that are operating. We need to know how many guards are at this operation. When do they take breaks?" Says Hatchett, "This is not a bunch of kids selling artwork." A former Defense Department analyst, Hatchett believes groups may be gathering intelligence for possible future attacks. Some organization, thinking in terms of a potential retaliation against the U.S. government, could be scouting out potential targets and looking for targets that would be vulnerable. And a source tells the Defenders of another federal memo stating that besides Houston and Dallas, the same thing has happened at sites in New York, Florida, and six other states, and even more worrisome, at 36 sensitive Department of Defense sites. "One defense site you can explain," says Hatchett, "well, that was just a serendipitous. 36? That's a pattern." A federal memo stated that these art students may have had ties to an Islamic terror group. Remember the bombing of the King David Hotel in 1946 and how the Arab terrorists were actually Afghan terrorists? Remember the Zionist terrorists caught in Mexico with Arab passports? Remember the official motto of the Mossad, by way of deception thou shalt do war? Are you getting the picture? Can you say false flag operations? Before his excellent work was silenced, Fox's Cameron reported this amazing bit of information. Investigators within the DEA, INS, and FBI have all told Fox News that to pursue or even suggest Israeli spying is considered career suicide. Did you catch that? If an investigator dares to mention Israeli spying, he has committed career suicide. And if a journalist like Fox's Cameron dares to bring this scandal to light, he is told to shut his mouth. If they persist, they may even be called anti-Semitic, a label which has served as the kiss of death for many a journalistic and political career. This means that Zionist mafia can do whatever it wants, whenever it wants, and however it wants, including orchestrating, financing, executing, and covering up the true story of events in the Middle East, the 9/11 massacre, and the ensuing war on terrorism, war on Israel's enemies. Now, do you remember the Mossad's warning about the 200 Al-Qaeda terrorists said to have been preparing major attacks in the U.S.? At the time of this writing, we are 1 year into the largest investigation in American history, and not one of these 200 terrorists has yet to be uncovered. But 200 Israeli spies were uncovered, among them many military members, electronics experts, wiretapping and phone tapping specialists, and explosives experts with the skill to bring down tall buildings. Logic and common sense leads to the conclusion that the 200 Al-Qaeda terrorists were in reality 200 Zionist terrorists sent to frame the Arabs for terrorist attacks and drag America into a war. History repeats itself. But who will teach this history to the American people when the Zionists control the information industry? The Zionist mafia and their ass-kissing careerist henchmen in media, government, academia, and business have all of the bases covered. In January of 2001, 9 months before the 9/11 attacks, a well-known economist and political figure with worldwide intelligence connections issued the following prediction: a new Middle East war of the general type and implications indicated will occur if certain specified incidents materialize. It will occur only if the combination of the Israeli government and certain Anglo-American circles wish to have it occur. If they should wish it to occur, the incidents to explain that occurrence will be arranged. Contrary to widespread childish opinion, most of the important things that happen in the world happen because powerful forces intend them to happen, not because of some so-called sociological or other statistical coincidence of the types reported for the popular edification of the easily deluded. A new Middle East war, bigger than any yet seen, is inevitable under presently reigning global influences. The man who made that prediction is the perpetual presidential wannabe Lyndon LaRouche. Now, LaRouche may be a cult-like figure with some really weird interpretations of history, but his intelligence contacts are legitimate and many of his political and economic forecasts have been accurate in the past. Considering all the history and recent events reviewed in this paper and the logical conclusions which they lead us to, the above prediction was right on the money. The Zionists, and also Anglo-American internationalist interests, do not conceal their desire for World War III, with American troops doing dying. They pulled off 9/11, turned us into Arab-hating fanatics, put an American flag in our hands, and are marching us off to die for Zionism. Just read what Rahane Ungesen, a senior advisor to and spokesman for Ariel the Butcher Sharon, said in an interview with the Arizona Daily Star in April of 2002, the terror attacks on September 11th and extreme turmoil in the Middle East point to one thing, World War III. We've been fighting a war for the past 18 months, which is the harbinger of World War III. The world is going to fight, whether they like it or not, I'm sure. Here's another warmongering, inflammatory quote from Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, urging the U.S. to attack Iraq. Attacking Iraq now would be quite dangerous, but postponing it would be more dangerous. The problem today is not if but when. And here's another warmongering quote from an editorial that former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wrote for the New York Post headline today, "We are all Americans. What is at stake today is nothing less than the survival of civilization. I have absolute confidence that if we, the citizens of the free world, led by President Bush, will marshal the enormous reserves of power at our disposal, harness the steely resolve of a free people, and mobilize our collective will to eradicate this evil from the face of the earth." The international terrorist network is thus based on regimes Iran, Iraq, Syria, Taliban Afghanistan, Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority, and several other Arab regimes such as the Sudan. For the Bin Ladens of the world, Israel is merely a sideshow. America is the target. Note the ominous similarity between Netanyahu's lies and the first words that Sivan Kurtzberg, one of the dancing Israeli movers, spoke to arresting police officer on 9/11. "We are Israelis. We are not your problem. Your problems are our problems. The Palestinians are your problem." Recall Netanyahu's September 11th comment about the attacks being very good for Israeli-U.S. relations. The title of the New York Times article which carried that comment was, "Spilled Blood is Seen as Bond That Draws Two Nations Closer." Ariel Sharon used the same linking tactic in a speech before the notoriously defamatory Zionist Anti-Defamation League. "There is a moral equivalency and direct connection between America's continuous operations against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and any other Israel Defense Forces operation to defeat terrorism," Sharon said in a speech Monday to the Anti-Defamation League. "They are acts of self-defense against the same forces of evil and darkness bent on destroying civilized society." Notice how Sharon, Netanyahu, the Israeli movers, and the totally Zionist-dominated New York Times and New York Post all use the same strategic tactic of linking the interests of the U.S. with the interests of Israel. The same ploy was utilized in the anthrax letters, "Death to America. Death to Israel." Do see how these evil Zionist bastards play the game? They turn their enemies into our enemies while pretending to be our allies. They laugh and celebrate as thousands of innocent Americans are burned and crushed to death. And when someone dares to shine the light of truth upon them, they label you an anti-Semite. Can you not see that we've been played for fools? Behold this bit of bold hypocrisy by American Jewish Congress President Jack Rosen. "I don't think Palestinians celebrating the death of thousands of Americans should go unchallenged." Is that so, Jack? What about the Israelis who celebrated the death of thousands of Americans? Why haven't you challenged that? Now read this quote from the Prince of Darkness himself, Pentagon big shot and Zionist fanatic Richard Perle. "Neither the President nor the British Prime Minister will be deflected by Sodom's diplomatic charm offensive, the feckless moralizing of peace lobbies, or the unsolicited advice of retired generals." Perle not only lays down the policy line for Bush, but apparently for British Prime Minister Tony Blair as well. And note how casually he dismissed the sound advice of those retired generals, who warned that a war against Iraq was unnecessary. But what does Perle care? His kids won't be dying. As always, it will only be the children of the flag-waving masses, which Perle and his Zionist brothers and sisters see as nothing more than cannon fodder for Zionism, who will do the fighting and killing. What threat did Iraq ever pose to the U.S.? None. Iraq and other Arab nations are to be crushed so that Israel can have a freer hand to expand in the Middle East. It appears that George Bush goes along with the wishes of these Zionist gangsters for his own political protection and slash or advancement, but it is unclear as to what extent he is truly in agreement with them. Bush and Cheney may even be under some form of blackmail. But they also represent oil interests, and the Caspian Sea area is rich in oil and minerals. Plans have been in the works for years to build pipelines to take the oil from the Caspian through Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then out to sea. The oil angle may be a secondary contributing factor behind the war on terrorism, one much nearer to the hearts of Bush/Cheney than the cause of Zionism. It is clear from just the well-publicized information that the president had at least some type of knowledge that a major attack was coming. Do you remember Bush's strange behavior when he was first told of the attacks? He was reading to a group of Florida school children when his chief of staff Andy Card whispered the news of the second tower being hit in New York. instead of just calmly excusing himself and apologizing to the kids for having to leave suddenly, Bush quickly shifted his eyes at the camera, turned somber, and then returned to reading for another 15 minutes. Our major cities were under attack, 1,000s of his countrymen were burning or jumping to their deaths on live TV, and more planes were still unaccounted for. Yet Bush just sat there with a stupid look on his face and then went back to reading a story about a goat. Is this the reaction of a man who was truly surprised by these horrible attacks? Or is this more indicative of the reaction of a guilty person who, like FDR just before Pearl Harbor, was expecting an attack and therefore was not surprised? There is one more interesting coincidence worth mentioning. During the whole time that these terror attacks were expected, Bush was out of Washington, D.C., on what the media had dubbed the longest vacation in presidential history. Time magazine of August 5, 2002 explains, getting ready for a vacation can be so hectic. It certainly was for George W. Bush last week. While Laura Bush left the White House early to get the ranch in Crawford, Texas, ready for a month-long holiday, one of the longest in presidential history, the president rushed through some last-minute errands. Bush was in Texas for the entire month of August, returned to the White House briefly, then left again, and ended up in a Florida classroom on September 11th. What a tough job, eh? Is this of any significance? Well, I don't know about you, but if I had the kind of intelligence network and advance warning that we know certain people had, and surely a sitting U.S. president would also have had, I would not have been in Washington, D.C., on 9/11 either. There are many politicians and journalists in America who carry the Zionist S water for them only because they are careerists who understand very well from whence their bread is buttered. My suspicion is that if Bush doesn't deliver a war against Iraq and then WW3 against other Arab states, Jolie Berman may be installed as president in 2004, with McCain running as an independent to draw votes away from Bush. Will Bush, like Wilson in WWI and FDR in WW2, go all the way and deliver WW3 to the Zionist mafia? At the time of this writing, it does appear that way. But if Bush should hesitate, like his father did in 1991, to go all the way, the Zionist mafia will try to replace him with Lieberman in 2004. Iraq knows who is behind the planned attack on their nation. In an interview with CBS's Dan Rather, Aziz accused the Zionists, this war which the Bush government is planning does not serve the basic interest in the long run of the American nation. It serves the imperialistic interest of Israel and the Zionist groups, who have now a great say in the American policy. How sadly ironic it is that the Arabs know that the Zionist mafia dominates America, but the American people are oblivious to it. But who will tell the American people if the Zionists dominate the media too? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we have established that the political force of Zionism is a dangerous supremacist movement, and that its leaders have always placed the interests of international Zionism ahead of the interests of their respective nations. We have demonstrated that the Zionist mafia will send unsuspecting Americans to war to fight for their interests. We have seen how Germany and Great Britain were selfishly used for their purposes. We have demonstrated the role played by Zionism in helping bring about some of the 20th century's greatest disasters, such as World Wars I and II and the Treaty of Versailles. We have learned about Zionist massacres of unarmed Arab civilians and Zionist terrorism designed to frame Arabs and poison relations between the U.S. and Israel's Arab enemies. We learned about the awesome Zionist power structure that exists in America, covering the Congress, the Pentagon, the mass media, and more. We have established that the Zionists, through their media monopoly, have the ability to cover up and conceal some of the most amazing stories of both the past and present. We have established a primary motive to turn the U.S. into a nation of Arab haters and Israel lovers eager to go to war against Zionism's Arab enemies. We have established a secondary motive to brutally crush the Palestinian resistance under the cover of a major U.S. war on terrorism. Sharon's tanks were unleashed on September 12th in a major escalation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because of the 9/11 attacks, few noticed, and still fewer even cared. We have established numerous precedents for these type of false flag operations, as well as cases of Israeli agents impersonating Arab terrorists, Levon Affair, USS Liberty, Mossad agents caught with Arab passports, Muslim impersonators caught in India, etc. We have established that the Zionists have the logistical capability and the opportunity to orchestrate such an operation. Best intelligence service in the world keep positions of power at the Pentagon and in U.S. intelligence, experts with explosives, access to WTC, access to Logan Airport and U.S. Air and American Air, unlimited supply of money, able to thwart investigators with phony wire translations and U.S. mules, etc. We have established that the Zionist-controlled media has the ability to cover up the facts contained in this paper. Even after the stories had initially penetrated their own media screens, we have established that the Zionists have the power to ruin the careers of U.S. congressmen, senators, presidents, law enforcement officials, and journalists. Conversely, they also have the power to advance the careers of those who serve their interests. We have seen that they have the ability to block investigations as well, misdirect, and thwart existing investigations. We have established that the Zionists were the beneficiaries of the 9/11 attacks, whereas the Arabs have been hurt greatly by the 9/11 attacks. We have exposed numerous lies linking Arabs to 9/11. We have established how evidence against Arabs was planted and contrived in order to misdirect investigators, wording of anthrax letters, phony passports, stolen passports, Qurans, and Arab flight manuals left conveniently behind for FBI filed agents to find in cars and forgotten suitcases, at a passport surviving the blast and floating down to Earth, etc. We have established that 7 of the 19 hijackers are alive and well. We have established that a small army of Mossad agents was caught planning terror acts in America and Mexico. We have seen how anxious the Zionists are to use 9/11 as a pretext to crush the Palestinian resistance and to have the U.S. attack Iraq and other nations. We have established all of this and so much more. In addition, there is a plethora of even more damning facts which, in the interests of time and space, weren't even included in this paper. The only logical conclusion that a reasonable person can arrive at is this: the 9/11 attacks, the anthrax murders, and numerous other foiled terror plots were planned, orchestrated, financed, carried out, and covered up by the forces of international Zionism. What other logical explanation can there be? As incredible as this may seem, what other conclusion is there that can so neatly tie up all of the loose ends and mysteries related to 9/11? This is the only scenario into which the many pieces of the 9/11 jigsaw puzzle snap snugly together to reveal a clear image. Now compare this to the official explanation of 9/11, which requires us to force, bend, recreate, and manipulate puzzle pieces. Even in the face of this mountain of facts, there will still be those who will go into denial and casually dismiss this whole case as just another silly conspiracy theory. But the funniest conspiracy theory of all is the theory that some Saudi caveman and his network of Arab students managed to elude U.S. investigators and pull off the most sophisticated intelligence operation in world history. You can continue to believe that fairy tale if it makes you sleep better at night and if your sense of credulity can't stand the burden. Or, you can muster the moral and intellectual courage to free your mind from Zionist bondage and face the ugly truth for what it is. You can join the extremists and make a commitment to share the horrible truth with others, or you can smirk, roll your eyes, and poo-poo everything you've just read. Go back to your controlled TV news, pretend this problem doesn't exist, and let Messrs. Rather, Brokaw and Jennings do your thinking for you while the world goes to hell in a Zionist handbasket. The choice is yours. History and posterity will judge your actions accordingly. To borrow a line from the Maximus, hero of the film Gladiator, what we do in life echoes in eternity. A passionate attachment of one nation for another produces a variety of evils. Sympathy for the favorite nation, facilitating the illusion of an imaginary common interest in cases where no real common interest exists, and infusing into one nation the enmities of the other, betrays the former into a participation in the quarrels and wars of the latter without justification. It leads also to concessions to the favorite nation of privileges denied to others, which is apt doubly to injure the nation making the concessions, by unnecessarily parting with what ought to have been retained, and by exciting jealousy, ill will, and a disposition to retaliate in the parties from whom equal privileges are withheld. and it gives to ambitious, corrupted, or deluded citizens who devote themselves to the favorite nation, facility, to betray or sacrifice the interests of their own country, without odium, sometimes even with popularity, gilding, with the appearances of a virtuous sense of obligation, a commendable deference for public opinion, or a laudable zeal for public good, the foolish compliances of ambition, corruption, or infatuation. George Washington.